as a content advisor is supposed to do, but to be fair to him, he only joined us about 6 weeks ago and already is making a huge impact. And I'm feeling much calmer and better because he's here, because then he can do the job a content advisor is doing. The PBO is now liberated from its role, and I myself, hopefully, while I'm here at least, will be relieved of some of the things I've been doing. So Kayla has gone through the minutes. We have raised this with the Secretary to Parliament about the quality of minutes and so on, nothing reflecting on our two very good secretaries. And we've raised it with the other authorities. So in the view of the number of issues we have to deal with today, I'm asking that we do what we've done before, is table them as it were and adopt them in general, rather than going through each. But in theory, all of us would have read this thing last night. I take it the DA had a caucus meeting at 9 o'clock this morning, and it was 2 o'clock this morning and has been through it. So Parliament being where it is, the resources being what we have, can I suggest we do what we've done over the last 2 years? But the majority want to go through each set of minutes and amend them as you like and so on. I'm fine by that. Yes, Mr. Mania.
Chair, just 2 points. One point on the agenda and the other a point on the minutes. On the minutes, I am happy to adopt them in general, provided you confirm that any amendments which we have put to the various bills are included or attached to those minutes.
And you're going to raise that. Sorry, I meant to say that. They will be attached, yes. I think it's best to put it there because, I mean, to be fair to the average committee secretary, or to be fair to the average MP, let alone, it's sometimes very difficult. I mean, take tax bills. I looked at some of the minutes. It's very hard to expect the committee. So having said that, can we agree that we will have a general move and a seconding on each of the minutes, and we'll put it as a collective motion, right? So can we have a mover on the minutes? So now we're stuck. There's no mover. Okay, and seconder? Good. All right. Thank you very much. Now you want to raise something else, yes?
The second point concerns the agenda. We're going to deal with the minutes and then the FICA bill, which of course is amendment bill, which is the main item. But I'd also like to put the financial sector regulation bill on the agenda.
Jafred is here today.
No.
I think Alan, you didn't put it on the agenda. Yeah, because look, this only happened yesterday at 1:30. Okay, so maybe I should do that, right? On the agenda then is the adoption of the minutes, the FSR bill outstanding clauses, and the FICA process, and the program. So, Tebowo, will you guide me or Alan, right? Just remember, those are four items on the agenda, and anything under general. So I think let's dispense with issues we can deal with quickly. On the program, you've got it since last Thursday. Why don't we deal with that quickly? Remember, it's a draft program. And remember, too, that often we have to change it because Parliament decides to scrap a committee week or a committee day. That happens far too often. We've complained repeatedly as chairs, and 22 years later, we have failed. Right? So in short, in regard to that, in regard to the program, Alan, because he was here for the whole year, Tebowo has just come. She's actually, what she's done is, between the two of them, Alan and her, and Tebowo, they give you the list of items we have for this year. I see the deputy minister here. I'm not sure, of course he's free to be here, but we're looking at the FICA bill. Yeah? So you want to be here? Okay, that's fine. But let me put this to you. On the program, is there anything you want to suggest? Now, remember, it's a draft program. Do you want to add anything? Right, I take it the program is fine for now. Yes.
Chair, I haven't managed to have a careful look at the program. I know that SARS is on the program. I just think that we need to, in view of what's going on at SARS, see SARS as early as possible in the program. That's all.
I knew you were going to say that. I thought you were going to say it in a reverse way, that the day... You see, the SARS comes here anyway with the National Treasury when we look at the budget, right? But the issues that we are, I haven't written to the commissioner. I will phone him today and write to him. The committee's agreed on the issues, right? But I see Mr. Mania also posed questions in the House along similar lines, which he has got a reply to at least one, which was forwarded to us. I think, Cindy, if you can arrange for that to be forwarded to Alan, because the minister has already replied, right? So, okay, can we put that on the agenda? In the first meeting, we can discuss it. But you see, given the FIC bill, given the IRBA hearings, which you have to have before the end of January, and given the budget process, we'll try to do it before the SONA debate or immediately after the MTBPS process. I think that's how it is currently. Am I right, Alan? It's the first sitting, if I'm correct, after the MTBPS process. We can change it. The financial sector hearings, I think, will probably last 2 days. Maybe we can move that back by a few days. So we can juggle that around. So in principle, there's no problem. In fact, the ANC itself has been asking similar questions to the ones that you seem to have already asked in the House, or not seemed you have. So on the program, in principle, what we're saying, the program is fine for now. We will, when we have our first meeting, adjust. The first meeting is on the FIC bill. And exactly what we do then is something we'll decide at the end of this meeting. So that's dispensed with. Now, on this matter, you will recall, colleagues, you have a one-pager on the corrections on the financial sector. You will recall that we discussed this last week, I think it was the week before, 2 weeks ago, and we said if we're going to vote on this bill, we have to bear in mind that it runs into, I don't know, what is it, 200 and somewhat pages, right? There's a whole lot of schedules, which Sifiso Buthelezi managed on our behalf, very ably, may I add, which we had adopted the week before. But actually what would happen is that if we changed any of the amendments that have implications for the schedules, then obviously it'll be consequential amendments. You'll recall this is the first time the committee, it's the only committee that's done this. Melanie, you might be interested to know. We are now doing it via tracking. Right? It's taken Parliament at least 10 years to catch up with ICT. So we've tried to do it with tracking. And we thought that's the best way to go forward. Now, I'm raising this particular EFF is here. They're the only party not privy to this decision. So that's why I have to alert you to it, because you have a right to be, this is a process matter, and you have a right to be a bit, let's say, understanding about Parliament's capacity and so on. So I'm explaining this in great detail because I know what, well, I don't know what Floyd would say, but in fairness to him, he was not here. We can tell you, as I recall, if members disagree with my understanding of what we agreed to, you can obviously defer with me. But we decided, look, we're going to vote on this bill. In our report, we say, look, we need fresh minds. We said also that, look, this is maybe a Section 75 bill, but Charles and them on that side, they must look at this bill as if it's a 76 bill, and we will, even if they make no changes, we'll look at this bill again. Right, that was our approach. And because of the way we were processing things, and because we all agreed finally to vote on the last day that we could vote, which is yesterday, I did alert the committee that it's possible, because we're using this new system, which we hope the whole parliament will agree. Ah, you are here, Mr. Kwanko, as well. You need to know this. You see, it's the first time we used the tracking system. It should have been done 10 years ago. So what actually happened is we said, instead of having an A version of the bill and a B version of the bill and all that, why don't we just put it all into one bill and just delete tracking? You know, the thing that says, what? Delete all... accept all comments. But at the last minute, there were some negotiations between the NCR and the Department of Trade and Industry and our department, right? And even then, I alerted the committee to the fact that it's possible that you could find cross-referencing when you get to the printing gets a bit distorted. You might find a few words get lost. There are two options we have. We can, if we discover it before the debate, in good time before the debate, then we can take it to the House. As long as we can show that that's what the committee amended, maybe a line got lost or two lines got lost or cross-referencing is wrong, we can introduce it and ask it gets done now and then. And all parties agree to do that because that's what we've agreed to do. Even if a party disapproves of the particular, let's say, clause that got left behind accidentally. However, late on Friday night, Momo rang me to say, Eunice, there's a problem. And then they were thinking of introducing it in the House, and I said, no, you'll have to call a committee meeting. How are we going to get a meeting at 9:30 in the morning? Then we've got to agree on this thing, and then we'll have to take it, we have to write a letter to the Speaker, and so on. It's not in your hands, it's in Parliament's hands. And finally, I will take the responsibility and report back to the committee. I met with them at 1:30 yesterday. You have the amendments, they will explain their side. But to be fair, you know what, when I heard them, it's really a human error. The last amendments we made, there are two of them and one consequential one, got lost. They deal with the NCR, and I suggested to Momo, it might be seen as a conspiracy, really. It's the first thought that will enter the DTI stroke NCR people. It is deliberate that this happened. But I'm convinced, really. In fact, I must say, usually in the civil service and in Parliament, everybody passes the buck and says, no, it's not me. It's him or her. But this is a reverse situation. Everybody was taking responsibility. Everybody says, no, it's not him or her. It's actually me. It's not him, it's me. Everybody was taking responsibility. As I understand the rules and the conventions in Parliament, the two committee secretaries, in this case two, are meant to ensure this happens. That every amendment is printed. Now, I don't think it's fair to expect that one of them just came a few months ago, 2 months ago. It's not fair. And Ellen is overburdened. And it's Frank Jenkins on behalf of the legal unit. But it's Janine also that to some extent dropped the ball, as it were. So more of them are taking responsibility for what is really a parliamentary human error. Parliament is saying we accept responsibility. Neil Bell was brought on. And quite frankly, up till Sunday afternoon, Monday I contacted, I've been breathing down their necks, it's all done. So I did what I could, but then I think ultimately maybe I'm responsible. So we are pleading for understanding. What we have opted last week to do, as you'll remember, is to rather hand this over to the NCOP and say, look, these were two or three things that happened. Can you adopt this in the first instance? Because we did so in the NA, and then decide whether you accept the merits of them. Two or three things that have been lost. I have spoken to Charles three times, including this morning at about half past 8. I have spoken to Sipa Mandla from DTI. He says no, he understands. He doesn't think there's any conspiracy. I've spoken to Lesiba Mashaba, and he's very cool about it. He says no, look. So what I'm proposing is that we look at this thing, get an explanation, and then the proposal, consistent with last week's decision, is that we write to Charles De Beer and say, look, regrettably this happened. It's human error, and can you kindly adopt these amendments on your side in the first process of processing this bill, and then you can decide on the merits or demerits of it. In any case, there are other things they'll pick up in the bill, which I'm sure we'll have to attend to anyway. So that, in a nutshell, not a nutshell, it's as full as bill because the two of you were not here. Having said that, can we hear National Treasury very briefly, because it's all there on paper, and then we'll come to the members to speak.
Thank you, Chair. Chair, just to correct, we obviously told you this on Monday night, not Friday night. Monday night. And what we've done, we've got a one-pager, which Roy will circulate, which just outlines the errors that we picked up on Monday, and which we certainly just want to make public. That they were inadvertently missed. Obviously, we should have read, but I'm convinced by the Chair, there may be also a few other small errors we'll find as we get to the NCOP. I just think I don't know why it happens, it happens. So we will get that corrected, but I think the three substantial ones, you see one, there was just the omission of the word only. The second one was the two paragraphs that were replaced, and the third one was in relation to a consequential, just a few words that were missing, which we've put out in red on the handout. So these certainly were adopted by the committee, adopted in principle, but when we voted, they had been left out. So the version you voted on yesterday was the version that you had formally passed. So, yeah, and I think we just regret the error and apologize and go down on our knees and say sorry.
To you. You see this thing of using the tracking system, we should use it fully. What we should have done, I've thought about it since I met you guys yesterday, I was thinking about it. We should have put the, what we call the end document, into the track version in a different color. You know, it all appears as red. And if it's moved around, it's green. We should have put it in a different color. So the problem would never have occurred. So it's also a learning exercise. The first time we use the tracking system. My imagination, if that's not the right, my expectation actually, is that this will become the norm. So if National Treasury independently introduces a new provision based on exchanges it's had outside this meeting or under our sort of watch, as it were, then it should be in an underlined or in a different color. So we never have like the end document there. We have to call the end document because we had N3, N29, the date was the 29th. So I think now the lesson we learned from this is that it has to be put in a different color. And this is a thing that I will, over the constituency period, write a proposal on and take to the House chair for the chairs to look at and take to the SDP and so on. Because I think Parliament should do it like this. So there is a lesson to be learned from this experience. We should never have had an end document. We should have had it in a different color but put it in the same document. Struck me after I parted with you guys yesterday. Right, that's done. Okay, Mr. Mania, please hand up.
I did speak with Mr. Mania yesterday.
Thank you, Chair. I mean, I accept the explanation from the National Treasury that an error was made. I don't take issue with that. But, I mean, National Treasury say they don't know why it happened. I do know why it happened. It happened because this committee rushed the bill in the last phase. That's why it happened.
No, you
and the lesson learned here is that we, as a committee, should not be rushing the bills in the final phase.
No,
that is why it happened. But that's not the real issue, Chair. The real issue is timing. When did we become aware of the problem? Now, my understanding was we became aware of the error after the debate had taken place in the National Assembly. But it now emerges that, in fact, at least National Treasury, and on National Treasury's version, you and perhaps other people at Parliament were aware of the error on Monday night prior to the bill being debated. So the remedy then should have been different. We could have postponed the debate to today or later in the day and reprinted the bill so the National Assembly voted on the correct version of the bill, because what's happened is this committee has passed one version of the bill and the National Assembly has passed another version of the bill. And given the fact that we knew in advance that there was an error in the bill, we should simply have reprinted the bill, distributed to members, and postponed the debate to late yesterday evening or to today. I mean, I take real issue with the fact that you, possibly other officials at Parliament and National Treasury, knew in advance that this had occurred.
What is responsible for programming?
And caused the National Assembly to vote on the wrong version of the bill. It is totally unacceptable, Chair.
Stop the drama, David. Look at the issues that we need to deal with.
Actually, can I just...
Don't forget the drama.
Okay. I can just... Okay, sure.
But can I tell you something before you do that? Actually,
the bill we voted on is the bill that got printed, right? So actually, that's not correct. In other words, because we use the tracking system, we voted on the, everybody agreed with this thing. You yourself agreed with it, right? That was the only way out. Secondly, we did say that if glitches occur, with the minutes, you can look at the minutes, it will be done through the NCOP. But I'll respond to your other things. But let me clarify, it's not correct. Am I right, Frank? The bill that we voted in the House is the bill that we voted last week Wednesday. And that bill that we voted last week Wednesday left out these three things. So it's not correct, Mr. Mania, that we voted on another bill. What you may say, of course, is that the bill we voted on Wednesday in the committee was the bill that actually was not inclusive of these three things. All they did was print it. In fact, they had the early prints. You remember you had a copy of it, right? So it's not correct. Let me clarify that. It is not correct. Frank, can you help here? It is not correct that we voted on one bill last Wednesday and another in the House yesterday. It was the same bill. And before anybody misunderstands, let me put the facts here. I have no reason to be dishonest. Well, what am I going to get out of it, really? At my age, 23 years later, I mean, really, what am I aspiring to be? Let me think. President, maybe? Yeah, I can't be anything more than a minister, right? So now, what? I told you yesterday. We learnt it late on Monday night. When I exchanged with you yesterday, you never raised this thing. Obviously, there's media here and so on. But even by that measure, David, I rang you, which I don't like doing, but I have to do it. I rang you because I didn't know the other two members are going to come. I mean, Floyd hardly ever comes. Mr. Kwanka hardly ever comes because of the other responsibilities. If I had known, I would have phoned them. I've been very open cards here. They told me at about, I can look at my phone. Okay, I'll tell you what. I'll show you my phone. You can see he rang me at about 10:30 on... Monday night. Then on Tuesday morning, Cindy rang me while you were on a flight to say that can we introduce it in the House? And I said no, because we've already taken a decision to go to the NCOP. You know what we can do? Right, I'll tell you what. I will play the recordings. We'll go to Vodacom, we'll play all the recordings. So I commit myself to giving you my recordings. Nobody lied. And we took a decision. Can you show the minutes? Where's the minutes? Sakela, I want to see the minutes. Last week, Wednesday, we took a decision. We'll take it to the NCOP. Right. So let's get the facts right.
Okay, Mr. Chairman, thank you for the clarity. So essentially what happened was that when the committee dealt with the bill last week, we made, the error had already been made, and so, I mean, that, absolutely, I think David has pointed out, the error is the error, it was just the process. So, you know, that error occurred then, the error was discovered on Monday, and we voted on it despite knowing there was an error on it, and what the consequences are, I'm simply, for my own mind, putting the sequence straight. Okay. But, Mr. Chairman, there's one other thing. I don't know what other members of the committee, I know David got, but I've yet to get a copy of this bill. I'm told by David he got it in his pigeonhole about 20 minutes before the sitting yesterday. I still haven't got it. And to me, that's fairly serious. So I don't know how that happened. As my understanding is, every member of Parliament has to get a copy, not just the members of this committee. So I hope that I'm the only one who didn't get one, and not a whole lot of people. But let me say again, David got his before the sitting. I didn't, and even as we speak, I still haven't got it.
Everything was confirmed at about 3 p.m. on Monday. The bill was printed. They all sent me emails. Neil Bell, yourself. That we can check. Does anybody want to answer that?
We had a debate prior to the House sitting about whether it wouldn't be necessary raising, actually delaying the debate and stopping the bill on the basis that the bill, in fact, had not been distributed to members. I received the bill, I think, 15 or 20 minutes before the debate. And I checked clause 137, and I had no time to check the balance.
Can I ask something? What happens when the bill gets printed? Where's Mr. Bell? He's not here. Can you explain, Frank, who distributes it? I mean, I don't know. These are like administration issues, really. There's no conspiracy here. It's the last week of Parliament, really. Honestly.
Once the bill is finalized, all the proofs have been done, and we give them the go-ahead, CREDA prints the bill and brings it to us. 450 copies, and then we ask people to distribute it and put it in the pigeonholes. Now, what I do know is that on Sunday evening, there was a problem with the printer, but we got 400 copies printed, and that was distributed, as far as I know. No, on Monday, because they delivered it on Monday to Parliament. So that should have been distributed on Monday or Tuesday. I'm not sure who exactly puts it in the pigeonholes. And maybe this bill is very sought after, being that there's a limited number. I don't know. But, Mr. Lees, I have an additional copy for you. And I hope I didn't get your... I have an additional copy. I will give you an additional copy before lunch today. although it's too late now, I know you've already...
We're chairless at the moment, so I'm going to jump in. Mr. Chairman, the issue is not so much about Alf Lees not getting a copy. It's just a failure in the system for even one member not to get a copy. And so perhaps we need to just ask for
that. Yeah. No, it's fine. Okay, now, can we get more responses from MPs? Please understand there's no conspiracy here. Mm-hmm. It's a human error. It's the last week of Parliament. I think it's really tough on the people who all admit. None of them is... In fact, it's absurd. All of them are saying, no, I'm guilty. I'm guilty, Chairperson. It's got nothing to do with you. I'm taking responsibility. So why don't we do this? Media, move a motion of no confidence in me. Let's settle the matter like that. Issue a press statement. Linda! I'll suspend
sure, if I thought I could win the vote, so I'd do it right now.
Yeah. Chairperson, I have no confidence in myself. Anybody wants to second it? Mania seconds it. Right. Fine. So now I apologize. I really regret it. I go down on my knees. It happened the first time in 13 years of chairing, but it has happened. I take responsibility. I should have sat on Saturday and Sunday and read every line and checked. I should have gone out and distributed it. Okay, Mr. Nkwanka.
Chairperson, thank you.
Is the deputy president of the party now.
Thank you.
This man is the deputy president of the party now.
Oh, Shabulela, thank you very much. Chairperson, I accept your apology. I understand that mistakes do happen. But the question I want to know was, did you at some point consider the possibility of delaying the debate when we're talking to Mr. Mania? I mean, when you knew, that's what I want to find out, because he's saying that proposal was made at the time. Was it not made? All right. Did you not consider to postpone the debate for yesterday?
Why? Because, okay, finish,
yes?
And then...
No, that's the question.
It's very simple. Last week we agreed, you can look at the minutes, that we will take it to the NCOP. All that has happened is the problems that surfaced actually to deal with like policy issues. I thought what will happen, as I keep saying, that this would happen was a reasonable expectation given the circumstances. We voted on the bill on Wednesday. It had to be printed by Monday night. It's the last week of Parliament. There's a whole lot of ATCs to finish, reports and all that sort of thing. My own view is that even if we had more time, it's not as if when you have a bill of this length that you will necessarily have avoided this. At best, it has reduced the prospects of this. On the matter of fast-tracking the bill, that has got nothing to do with this error. We have exhausted the bill, as Mr. Mania himself said in the House. He said he went on his knees saying, free, free, free at last. I wonder if he remembers where the term comes from. It's not part of his political ethos and background. So, hey, I don't know if he'll get understanding of what it actually means. But leave that aside. Right? The point I'm trying to make is that I personally don't believe that even if we had decided, okay, let's finish this bill on Wednesday, let's not vote on it, we'll come back and vote in January, that this thing wouldn't have occurred. It's entirely possible it would have occurred. Parliament has, unfortunately, over the last 10 years, done this several times. We are hardly the first thing. I had ruled out the reasons you're saying. I got to know late on Monday night. On Tuesday morning, we would have had to convene a meeting, right? And we all had other responsibilities, right? We actually wanted the House to finish on Thursday. Personally, I had pushed for the House to finish on Thursday, as was originally planned, because we wanted to have, as Mr. Mania knows so well, the insurance bill. We didn't know the FICA bill would come back, right? At least at the moment it did. So we're going to have the insurance bill this morning, briefing, and tomorrow we're going to have public hearings on the insurance bill, because it's been on our agenda for so long. I even suggested to Mr. Mania, right, and they had a meeting and decided that never mind that Parliament ends, the farewell speech is today. I had originally proposed the debate be today. Okay? Then Mr. Frolic and Mr. Bengal came back after having discussed it with his party and presumably Mr. I don't know if you're in the programming committee, Mr. Shivambu will know about this. They all decided that they can't sit here in this House simply to consider one bill. That they're going to finish today. They're going to have the Deputy President farewell speeches. There's no point sitting with our bill. So even though they said they're finishing Parliament today, I said, then I suggested them, let's discuss the bill today in the House. They came back to me to say, I have nothing to do with these things, right? I spent hours doing this work, right? They came back and said, no, once the deputy president speaks, we want a farewell speech. We do not want to discuss the financial sector regulation bill because people are going to be in a mood where they're going to oppose this bill and so on. And after that, it's not the right mood to have farewell speeches. I don't think it's fair to me, really, to report to you in such detail. I tried to negotiate Mr. Mania yesterday. I even tell him, actually I knew about it on Monday night. Now he's raising all sorts of questions, yet he forgets that last week he agreed we should take it to the NCOP.
You give him too much latitude.
Right, fine. Can you please respond now? What are we going to do?
I was first.
Thank you, Chair. I think now that we know what happened, we have been clarified, and there's an apology from National Treasury. I think we accept that apology. For me, the main thing is to, and whoever was involved, how do we take this process forward? I think we have heard history, and that's enough. How do we take this thing? What is the remedial action that we take? I think that's what I would like to hear. Sure, thanks.
No, Chair, I think given the amount of work that we have done on this, not only on this bill, but all the activities that we're involved in as this committee and treasury, mistakes like this do happen. But I don't think you have to take the blame because you are apologizing and I don't know for what. Because Treasury was the most relevant to apologize on it, which we accept. But we are also saying to Momo, try as far as possible to be meticulous on some of these things because, you know, these are small things that may create problems or unnecessary problems going forward. I mean, we have been doing all this work very well, and just at the last minute, something like this happened. It was unforeseen, but let's try as far as possible to avoid mistakes of this nature. Mm-hmm. From the side of Parliament, I think Advocate Jenkins must also help. The unit that deals with the making sure that those bills members receive. He must sit with that unit and say, let's make sure that all these things are distributed on time. We're not only doing it for SCOF because you are here, but it must be for all the activities of committees where bills must be made available to members. Let that thing happen accordingly, so that people don't just go there and debate and they don't even have copies and all those things, just to be on par with that particular committee. I mean, it must be an eye-opener also on your side. Chair, I also thought, last week we said on areas where we think certain things have to be done, from our side, if we might have not had an opportunity to do that, let us alert NCOP so that they are able to deal with all those things. I think the same must happen on this particular, the three issues that have been raised here. That's my submission to say, let's make them aware so that we are able to. Thank you, Chair.
Chair, my question remains, and we obviously need to move on. I mean, why, when the defect was brought to your attention on Monday night, did you not opt for the obvious solution, which was to reprint the correct version of the bill and pass that in the National Assembly? Surely that was the logical action.
To everybody, ma'am.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Chairman, You've made a point about people taking responsibility, a great number of people, and I just want to say a thank you to National Treasury for highlighting it, because if National Treasury had not been National Treasury, which is what they are, and didn't want to be in any way embarrassed, they could quite easily have just kept quiet, and that wouldn't have been good. And so to now castigate people for the error when the error has been highlighted and we can fix it, and that's actually, in that sense, a good thing. The fact the error happened, these things, you know, I don't know if I've told, narrated the story, Mr. Chairman, but you narrate stories, so I'm going to now. Many years ago, I had a lady as a PA who was really a very efficient and super, super lady. But I was fairly young and arrogant, and some of you will think I'm also still arrogant. But and on one occasion, I berated her for making an error, and she taught me a lesson that day that I've never forgotten. And she turned to me and she said, "Alf, you may be perfect, but the rest of us are human."
Yeah.
And that was a very important lesson in my life. And so, Mr. Chairman, may I just say that thank you for raising the issue and not trying to hide it, and let's deal with it. Thank you.
Look, can I summarize but also present my own views, because as a chair, these are things as chairs we have to think about. One is, I think we must remain with the tracking system. And we've learned a lesson here. It's our first experience of it, that we don't have an end document. We put it in a different color. So it's clear, it's come from National Treasury in their own brainstorming between committee meetings, which we should allow them to do, but it's not approved by the committee. So that's the first thing. Secondly, I really am going to write to the authorities and say this is a tracking system that we should use, although it went wrong here. Thirdly, it's hardly the first time this has happened. Fourthly, I want to remind members that we took a decision, we'll send it to the NCOP, and I've had three exchanges with Charles de Beer, not least this morning, and I've explained. He's cool about it. Fifthly, given the magnitude of this bill, given its gravity, given the length of this bill, given the amount of hours we spend, I don't think it's a big train smash, actually. I think it's unfortunate, but it's not the end of the world. We're not the parliament of Switzerland or Germany or something. We're a developing country. I don't think it's the end of the world. But it does point to the need to upgrade capacity. Advocate Jenkins is highly stressed. The legal unit needs to be upgraded, although Parliament's frozen jobs. And the two secretaries here, they really work hard. And so does Treasury. It was DTI, actually, that in exchange with Treasury also drew it to their attention. I've spoken to DTI, I explained to you. I spoke to Mashaba. He said he's not coming. He's cool about it. I spoke to Charles now. And he said he's cool about it. So the process will be, Sifisa, exactly what we agreed to last week. I will write to Charles and tell him that these are the three things we want you to include. And then you can decide whether you accept or reject it. That's your call. And let me repeat, lest people misunderstand. The bill we voted on Wednesday last is the bill that we voted on in the House. Let me also remind you, I am not able to turn around the entire programming committee. I would have preferred that we had public hearings on the insurance bill tomorrow and a briefing today. Yeah. But people said nobody's going to come. The DA itself said they wouldn't come. So there was no, like, sort of pressure from the Chief Whip's office for me to finish this bill, to steer it to its end. But what we were going to do with the bill. So I do think, however, where Mr. Mania may have a point, I don't agree with him that because we fast-track. I think the gap, we need to agree that bills beyond a certain number of pages or something, Parliament must set up an internal administrative process that requires committees. That's where there might be some value in what he's saying. Bills beyond a certain number of pages, there must be a gap of 7 days. And then, Frank, you and I will discuss it with the two secretaries. In January, I'll go with proposals and I'll report back to the committee on how to avoid this. But it has happened a lot in the last 5 to 7 years. I've been reading about it in the newspapers. But it doesn't affect the bill particularly. These three things are covered in different ways in the bill, really. It just amplifies things. So it's not like it's a major policy train smash, if there's such an expression you can use. Finally, I think all of us responsible for it apologize. We've learned a lesson here. It won't happen again. And can we please move on? Thank you very much. Now we're going to the last item on. So, yes, Frank.
Thank you for that. Just, my apologies as well. I've apologized to you on this.
Yes, an answer. Can you pursue this? Why were the bills not distributed on Monday afternoon when you all confirm to it is printed. Can you respond to that?
Yeah,
so, Mr. Lees, you'll get an answer,
written answer
in the next 48 hours, please.
Yeah, just on the issue of the tracking mechanism, our unit, we have a drafting unit, and they are looking into a electronic system to do drafting while the committee. So what we're trying to do is have the bill on the screen, and while we're doing the drafting, it will go into the bill. So when the committee is done, the bill is there, one copy only of it, which will then be distributed, and various people can work on the copy who has authority on it. It's a specific system for drafting legislation, but it's in its infant stages, but that is the, we are getting there, so if I may lobby, I mean, any kind of political pressure to get that going, I think would be good, because it will find its way into the budget eventually.
Thank you very much. It's 10 years later than it should have been, but fine, at least we're moving there. Can I then go to the last item on the agenda? We've done with everything else, right? The FIC and so on, yeah. Okay, can I just raise something? Sorry.
And moving to a paperless society, which is commendable, Honorable Tobias. But I think this thing we need to emphasize, it is very important, especially for us smaller parties, because it basically means that you're shifting the cost center from parliament to political parties. Right. It's okay, for an example, when it comes to order papers and question papers, it's not a problem. You can actually view those things using your iPad. But when it comes to thick documents, it means that as political parties, then we must print out those documents and have huge costs at the end of the month for printing. I've highlighted this thing in the Chief Whip's Forum. I said it doesn't work. That also includes, obviously, documents that we receive from portfolio committees, most of them, most of which we receive via email. It's problematic. If we want to improve the quality, enhance the quality of the contribution of MPs, we must make sure as Parliament that we support them. We give them documents on time so that they can prepare properly for meetings. I just wanted to put that on the record, Chair.
Although that should be addressed. Look, when I raise all these issues next year, in the first instance, Cedric Frolic, and then with Advocate Tao and the management, I will take that into account. I think it's useful you saying it, although a lot of what being discussed here is really administrative. Okay, having said that, can I just say, now we're looking at the FIC bill. As I understand what we're doing today, and members can guide, we are asking Advocate Jenkins, on behalf of the Legal Services Unit, to tell us what the process is when the President refers a bill back to Parliament on the grounds that it's unconstitutional. At least one of the provisions in this case is claimed it's unconstitutional. So what is the process, right? And then secondly, in considering the process, we've received two submissions, one from the Professional Forum, Progressive Professional Forum. It actually says it wants to make submissions, but it says more than just on the provision that is contested. It says there's glaring failures in the policies and so on. So that's what they want to do. And Advocate Jenkins will guide us on what are the parameters within which we can consider submission. Then the next issue is to go to, there's also a submission by the CASAC, right? They offer proposals, I think you would have seen it, on the way forward. I have no doubt there'll be other people who want to make submissions. We have to decide how we manage that process. And then he will give us an interpretation of the President's lawyer's document, which was sent to you last week. And then we'll hear from Treasury and FIC. And then we'll open it up for discussion around what exactly are the President's lawyers saying, and what is the initial response from Treasury and FIC. And then we will have to set out a program or process in broad terms for what we do when we get back here on the 24th of January. That's more or less it, right? In other words, we're not going to go now into strong arguments about the legal issues on both sides and so on, right? So what I'm saying is that that is what I think we're doing today, is mainly getting a clarity on the parameters within which we have to work, and then set a work program for late January when we get back. Right, is that okay? Let's see how it goes. If you want to add other issues, we can see how it goes. Thank you. Over to you.
Thank you, Chairperson, honorable members and colleagues. purpose of this presentation, as the chairperson indicated, is just give some food for thought. So what I've done is try to put as much information as I can on it, take it home in printed form, actually, so that one can read through it and prepare for when we deal with the bill. So there we have Section 79 of the Constitution. But basically says that it starts with the process, but what's important there is that if the President has a reservation about the constitutionality, he refers it back to the National Assembly. Only in certain instances will it also go through the NCOP after the National Assembly has dealt with it, otherwise just the National Assembly. Second important point is sub 2, the joint rules must provide for a procedure for the reconsideration of the bill. It's quite interesting that it must be the joint rules and not specifically National Assembly rules, but it's the joint rules. And then there are various options which are set out in the Constitution which the committee can then exercise when it reports. Now, the joint rules itself follows sort of the legal provision that the Constitutional Court has set out to say when the President refers a bill back, you only deal with the reservations of the President. You don't deal with anything else. The House has passed all the other things. The House is not giving a mandate to the committee, in other words, through the rules, to consider other things. The mandate of the committee is to look only at the reservations. So, and then to report on the reservations, either to agree to them, to say let's report an amended bill, or if the bill is so constitutionally wrong, to say, well, the bill must be scrapped, or then to say we do not agree with the President, and in which case the bill is just simply sent back to the President. So those are three options that can be done. Now, the joint rules distinguish between procedural defects and substantive defects. A procedural defect will necessarily go to the NCOP, for instance, a lack of public participation or a quorum issue. In this instance, there was no lack of public participation. So there's no mandate to redo that process over. Be that as it may, the committee can request or receive submissions, if it so decides, to deal with it. But it's really a legal issue that must fit squarely between the corners of the President's letter and reservations. It's not the first time a bill has been referred back, Chairperson. We have in 1999 and 2008, we had three bills referred back each of those years. So this year we're just under the record. We only have two. And I think it's about 11 bills in total that has now been referred back. And that's just a quick summary that our office keeps tab on these referrals as well as the reasons for it and how we've dealt with it before. At the moment, we're still dealing with the Performing Animals Protection one and the Financial Intelligence Center one. Now, the background to this one specifically, Chair, and I'm going to go into more details in the presentation. The President wrote to the Speaker on 28 November stating that he's referring it back in terms of 79.1. The crux of the President's concern is clause or the amended section 45B1C, 45 capital B brackets 1 capital C, which deals with warrantless searches. Now, the President is of the opinion that this limits section 14 of the Constitution, the right to privacy, and therefore it needs to comply with the limitation clause, which is set out in section 36 of the Constitution. President's lawyers and the President is not convinced that the standard set by section 36 is met. According to the letter, and this is for me an important point which the committee needs to look into, criminal prosecution may follow from such a warrantless search, and therefore it's even more important to make sure that there's an independent body like the judiciary making sure that there is a warrant given. The second point, other than the criminal issue, which the President highlights, is to say there's no limitation in respect of what you may search for, the subject of the search. So it's overly broad and there's too much discretion given to the officials. The President's recommendation is to look at 45 capital B brackets 1 capital C to make it expressly and carefully circumscribed. In other words, to say it is for a specific purpose and for nothing else. Now, just for background knowledge, the provision as it came from the Treasury, from Cabinet and Treasury as introduced in Parliament, was not amended by this committee. Point one, the original Section 45B of the FICA Act, the Financial Intelligence Center Act, states no requirement for a warrant. So all searches could have been done without a warrant, and that was the subject to a constitutional challenge. Which was then dealt with by the Constitutional Court, and I'll deal with that as well. The reasons for the referral in the President's letter I've try to highlight that through putting it in bold there, and I've quoted that section, which we've spoke about earlier, namely that there's no requirement for the center of the body to specify for the inspector what he or she may be searching for. So members can take that home and look at it carefully and to see and to understand what the president's reservation is. Because that reservation is the four corners within which we're going to operate when looking to correct this mistake, if at all. It's important to note that the president admits also that he may read into the provision those certain limitations which will make it more constitutional or constitutional for that matter, but he requires that it should be more express. So it becomes a little bit of a grey area, but it's something that the committee can discuss. The constitutional rights I refer to, section 14, section 36, I think we're all familiar with that, but in case we lose the constitution or whatever, it's there. I just want to highlight point 36, subsection 1E, because this is really where we will look at, is there a less restrictive means to achieve the purpose? In other words, we want to search for something, issue of non-compliance in the Financial Intelligence Center Act. How are we going to do it? We can do various methods. As soon as there's an infringement of a right to privacy, we should use the least restrictive means to achieve that object. You can't go into a china shop with a hammer, in other words. Chairperson, the Financial Intelligence Center Amendment Bill, as it is at the moment, it's one that the President referred back. I've quoted that as well as for information purpose. Subsection 1 is amendments, because that's parts have been moved, but that is not what the Constitutional Court was concerned about. And that deals really with searches, warrant searches, but it's warrantless searches in controlled areas, or what we call super registered areas, and so excluding all your private residents. Excluding private residents, let me just do it like that. From 1A is the amendments that were brought about as by the bill as introduced. And I've highlighted the underlying parts is not how we do the drafting. This is not for drafting purposes, for highlighting purposes. 1A expressly states that the inspector may enter for the purpose of determining compliance with the Act or any other order or determination or directive made in terms of the Act. And then it goes on and it says you can enter a private residence, which is what we're dealing with here, or any other residence, but on a warrant, 1B. Magistrate or judge may issue a warrant, and it sets out the grounds which must be considered by the judicial officer. 1C is the problem part, so warrantless searches. So an inspector otherwise required to obtain a warrant under 1B may enter any premises, including, of course, private home. With the consent of the owner, that goes without saying, although there's some academic debate about that, but it was not the problem that we're dealing with here. The problem is really not the consent area, but going in without consent and without a warrant. And the provision reads that the inspector must, on reasonable ground, believe that a warrant will be issued under subsection 1B, if the inspector applied for it. Now, Chair, if I can just pause here, this is where the issue lies. Is this clear enough that the purpose in which an inspector can go in is for compliance in terms of the Financial Intelligence Center Act? The reference to 1B in lawyers' language would say, well, there's a cross-reference, let's look what's written in 1B. When we go to 1B, we'll see there's a reference to 1A. And 1A states clearly that it's for the purpose of determining compliance with this Act or any order, determination, or directive made in terms of this Act. So, question is that clear enough? Can we make it clearer? That's my interpretation of the President's concern on that. For the sake of completeness, I've done the, and I think this is quite important, there's a new definition in the bill of non-compliance, and it excludes any criminal offences in terms of this Act. So it says clearly that it means a failure to comply with the provision of this Act or an order or determination or directive made in terms of the Act and which does not constitute an offence in terms of this Act. So if you go in terms of 1C to seek compliance by doing the cross-referencing to 1B and 1A and you come upon a criminal part or a criminal offence as an inspector, you can do really nothing about that other than to say, well, we can only make a criminal complaint and the police must go and collect that information. There's no mandate given to the inspector to seize anything that shows criminal offences, and should it be collected in that way, it would be inadmissible for evidence in a court case. Chair, I'm just referring here to the memorandum that came with the bill, because what we did, what the Treasury did with the amendments to 45B is to actually give effect to the Estate Agency Affairs Board versus Auction Alliance. So we can look at exactly what did the court do there, and did we follow what the Constitutional Court expected us to do? Because what it did, it found, it confirmed in parts the High Court order, and then wrote a section in that would have given effect to how it views the issue of warrantless searches. Chair, the issue of the Constitutional Court and how they phrased that judgment, the point whether you can have a warrantless search or not have a warrantless search and exactly where the line lies has been left for the legislature. It says, look, we're going to do a reading in and we're going to draw a line, but it's not the final line. It's there and we'll see what the legislature come up with, because this is only valid for the next, I think it was 18 months. Suspended for 18 months, and then it gave that reading in order, which is more or less the follow, well, not more or less, that's a cut and paste exercise. That is the order that was given. I want to stress from D. Can one see the... this is too complicated because you can't see the cursor on. One goes down the order, the fourth or fifth line from the bottom. An inspector otherwise required to obtain a warrant under paragraph A may enter and search any place without the warrant referred to in paragraph C if the inspector on reasonable grounds believes that one and warrant would have been issued in terms of that paragraph, and that the delay in obtaining the warrant is likely to defeat the object of the search. Now, Chair, that says to me various things. One, the question whether you should have warrantless searches or not is in fact answered by the Constitutional Court. It says, yes, there are instances which you need a warrantless search. Secondly, this part, the one which they're reading in here, concerns also criminal offences. Suspicion of also of criminal offences, which the Act actually takes a step backwards. And that's a big debate around that, I would suggest, because do you need less control or more control when you're doing an administrative inspection than to a criminal inspection? The consequences are more heavy with a criminal inspection, but the purpose for which you do the search might be more important in a criminal matter than in an administrative matter. So it's a balancing exercise, Chairperson, and there's a few questions that we can discuss as a committee. Is a warrantless search permissible? And I think we're going to deal with that now. If so, is it applicable only to criminal prosecutions issues or both the criminal and to administrative issues? And is the discretion in 45B1C, is it overly broad? Can we limit it? Can we make it clearer? Chair, that's it from my. I don't have any concrete answers. That was not my brief. Thank you, Chair.
And FIC, who wants to speak first, or how are you handling it?
Thank you, Chair. I think, Chair, what we're doing is a presentation of. Oh, okay. Is that part of your job description? Okay. Chair, I think what we're trying to do today is just to give a very broad overview of some of the issues, just to remind members. And I think if we, you know, we could go through it pretty quickly in the interest of time. But we need the presentation up. Has he got the final one? You sent it to Frank. Okay, have you got a hard copy? No. Well, anyway, let him start and do his. It's fine. I think it makes more sense if Peter comes. Yeah, okay. Well, Peter will start with the FIC to get to the detail. Let me just get the one on the stick there.
Do you have copies of your...
Sure. Thank you, Mr. Chair, and honourable members. I think just to.
Oh, sorry.
Just to. You want to go with that one? Or the other one? To explain the context and why this clause was brought to the committee as part of the amendment bill. It's obviously part of a broader structure of legislation that deals with combating money laundering. Financial Intelligence Center Act is one component thereof, and there are a few other pieces of legislation that completes that picture. And as we know, money laundering, the reason why countries around the world combat it is because it's about the exploitation of our financial systems for nefarious purposes. Criminals make use of our financial institutions that are supposed to provide services to the normal public for their own criminal ends, whether it's terrorism, perpetuating organized crime, etc. On the one hand, this empowers criminals financially, and they abuse that power to corrupt and manipulate our civil society. But it also undermines the stability of our financial system. So these are the two policy drivers why countries combat money laundering in general. Next slide. For a system to deal effectively with money laundering, its end objective should be to make sure that the adequate information about the dealings with our financial institutions are captured in the financial system, and that that information is accessible and can be used when it's necessary to investigate wrongdoing. So it's all about transparency being built into the financial system, and that starts with the institutions having to comply with a certain set of obligations to know who they're dealing with. It's called customer due diligence or transparency of the system. So once institutions know who they're dealing with, that information is then accessible for use by investigators, etc., after the fact. A key component of such a system is to make sure that institutions are properly supervised, to make sure they play by those rules, because they wouldn't necessarily do so of their own volition. Some might be because it's in their business interest, but it needs to be overseen by a regulatory or supervisory authority to make sure that there's a level playing field and that all institutions meet the same requirements. And it's in that context that we're dealing with the inspection authority of supervisors. Next slide. Obviously, when we implement something like this, we try to do it in accordance with an international standard. And in this case, the international standard is in the Financial Action Task Force recommendations. There's a specific recommendation about supervisory powers, recommendation 27. And in the methodology of the FATF that describes how this standard is assessed across the world, there's a specific reference to say that the supervisor's power should include the power to inspect institutions and to compel the production of information, and that power should not be dependent on an order of court having to be made to enable the supervisor to exercise this function. So that is the starting point at which the FATF approaches this. This standard has been used in assessments, or is being used currently in assessments. A number of countries have already been assessed against this. A few that have systems of supervision that was assessed to meet the standards. Examples of them are Canada, Singapore, Malaysia, Norway, there are a few others, where this particular issue was considered and where their supervisory powers were found to be effective and well adapted to the purpose that they need to meet. One example where a country was criticized in an evaluation was Australia, where for the particular reason that their inspection powers, equivalent to what we're providing for in Section 45B, is legally made dependent on either consent of the occupant of an inspected premises or a warrant having to be obtained. There's no third alternative. Either they must have the warrant or they must have the occupant's consent. There's no exception to the warrant in their law. And in the FATF assessment, that was found to undermine the effectiveness of a supervisor's capability to inspect institutions, and they were downgraded in their assessment on that basis. Now, coming to the actual issue that we're dealing with, and the process that brought us to consider the amendment to Section 45B, as Mr. Jenkins had explained, this originated out of the Constitutional Court judgment in the Auction Alliance matter. And not to repeat the explanation on the Constitutional Court's findings, but the essence of the finding in that case was that Section 45B took the approach that a warrant is never required to do an inspection. A supervisor always, as of right, may inspect the parties for which they are responsible. Constitutional Court said that can never be acceptable in our constitutional democracy. You have to have a differentiation between instances where a warrant would be required and instances where a warrant would not be required, and those have to be clearly described in law. And that was the distinction that was now brought in with the amendment to Section 45B that creates a category of types of inspections which supervisors would be able to do as of right. And those would be the institutions that they license or that they supervise. So the institutions that have already been subjected to their supervision of supervisory authority. That's subsection 1 of 45B. The category for which an exception is created, or a category for which the requirement to obtain a warrant is created, are those that have not subjected themselves to a supervisory authority, in other words, that are not licensed or registered or otherwise authorized to do their business. And particularly in the case, even if it's a licensed entity, where they operate from a private residence. And in many of the Constitutional Court judgments, it has been said that the private home is the inner sanctum of a person's private privacy. So there's a restricted access for even a licensed or regulated authority if they're supervised and inspected by a supervisor. That is in Section 45(1)(A). Section 45(1)(B) then sets out the grounds on which such a warrant may be issued, and the Section 45(1)(C) creates particular instances where, even though a warrant would be required, an inspector would be allowed in that particular circumstances to proceed with an inspection without first obtaining the warrant. So how this would work in practice is supervisor, for instance, the registrar of banks, banking supervision department, would inspect banks without a warrant, without any further requirements, because they are entitled to inspect banks, having licensed them and giving them the authority to operate. If they were to deal with a pyramid scheme, which is not a licensed bank, they would need a warrant if they wanted to carry out such an inspection, because this is an entity that sits outside of their scope of authority. So the Section 1A and 1B would apply. If they are of the opinion that in a particular instance it's of time is of the essence and they need to urgently carry out the inspection, or it's not an urgent case but the person in control of that premises that they want to inspect says, you're welcome, come in and inspect us, they are then allowed to proceed with the inspection without obtaining the warrant. So that's the structure of how the amended section will work. Now, coming to the specific concerns that were raised in the letter. And here again, our views are very similar to what Mr. Jenkins had explained earlier. It's important to understand that 1C does not permit warrantless searches in general. It's a deviation from a general rule that warrants are required, which is explained in 1A and 1B. And it creates an exception for particular instances where circumstances might make it expedient, or where there's no there's a waiver of the right to, by consent, of the right to privacy for the inspection to proceed. In those particular instances, would an inspector then be allowed to proceed without the warrant? So one needs to understand that the basis on which the inspector would carry out such an inspection without the warrant would be exactly the same basis as the base as where the inspection would have been carried out with a warrant, because this is a deviation from the norm that a warrant would have been required in ordinary circumstances. With that in mind, if we then look at the grounds on which such a deviation or exception is provided for in Section 1C, it's one of two grounds. Firstly, as I said, the consent of the person. Secondly, the purpose for the inspection might be frustrated if the inspector first have to go through the process of a warrant, but there's reasonable grounds for the inspector to believe that his application for a warrant would be successful if he had to make one. Now, those two grounds for the exception to a warrant requirement is found in legislation in many different instances. So if we first have to consider whether that, in principle, is an acceptable basis to deviate from the warrant requirement, I think we have to look at, firstly, Section 22 of the Criminal Procedure Act, because it contains exactly the same principled reasons to deviate from a warrant requirement. And in that case, we're talking about a fairly serious infringement on a person's privacy, because the purpose of that section is to allow a search for criminal evidence which can put a person in jail. It's very different from the inspection purposes that we're talking about in terms of the FRC Act. The consent ground for inspection is catered for in that section, and it's been considered by the Constitutional Court in relation to this section, particularly in the Criminal Procedure Act. And I think just to put this into context, over the lifetime of the inspection framework in the FIC Act, which commenced in 2010, officially actually started in 2011, more than 6,000 inspections have been done by the FIC and by other supervisors of institutions that are subject to the FIC Act. In only one of these 6,000 cases did an institution refuse consent to an inspection. That was in the Auction Alliance case, which then went all the way through the Constitutional Court. So by far and large, inspections are done on a consensual basis. Of course, it's a compliance, a regulatory requirement. It's not a criminal enforcement mechanism. The second ground for the exception is also contained in the Criminal Procedure Act and also found in many other pieces of legislation. And I've listed a few examples in a table there of other pieces of legislation that contain the same principle. The wording in these acts differ. They're not exactly the same. In some cases, private residents are included. Some cases, private residents are excluded. But by and large, the principle of consent and avoiding frustration is contained in all of these. There are at least three constitutional court judgments in which these issues were considered. The first was a case we refer to as the Gartner case. It's Gartner versus the Revenue Service, which considered customs legislation. And in that case, the court referred to Section 22 of the Criminal Procedure Act and these grounds for the exception to the warrant. Although it didn't pass any particular comment on it, it said that this is the sort of provision that the SARS officials should use if they want to inspect. In that case, it was a warehouse that is used for storing imported goods that would be inspected under the customs legislation. There was a more recent case, a 2016 case, Minister of Police versus Kunjana, in which the court again considered search and seizure powers. In this case, it was under the Drugs and Drug Trafficking Act. And the court struck down the provision in the Drugs and Drug Trafficking Act and actually specifically said that if you want to see the sort of example that you should use that's constitutionally valid, you should look at Section 22 of the Criminal Procedure Act. In the case of Auction Alliance specifically, the court read in a section that allows for an exception to a warrant requirement and specifically referred to the expediency requirement, where not to avoid the purpose of the inspection being frustrated. So I think in principle that is confirmed that it is constitutionally acceptable to deviate from a warrant in those circumstances. If we look at the specific concerns that are raised in the conclusion in the President's referral, I think firstly the point on the evidence being used to support a criminal prosecution, we agree again here with the explanation given by Mr. Jenkins earlier, and I think it's important to understand that an inspection is done as a function of a supervisor. The inspector doesn't have any independent powers which the supervisor doesn't have. So a supervisor's statutory functions do not include investigation of crime. So an inspector can't investigate crime if their employer, the supervisor, is not allowed to investigate crime. That in itself precludes the use of the evidence or the information that's obtained during an inspection to what the supervisor's functions are, which is to check compliance with the FIC Act. And that mandate is specified particularly in Section 45 of the FIC Act, and it's repeated again in Sections 45B, 1, 1A, and so on. So there are numerous places in which it's specifically made clear that a supervisor cannot exceed the scope of its own powers, which is to inspect for measuring compliance with the FIC Act. The consequences, therefore, of an inspection is that the material that's obtained through an inspection can only be used by the supervisor in their supervision and enforcement functions. In other words, it can lead to an administrative penalty in the end of the matter. But it cannot be used as evidence in a criminal proceeding. For that, there's a separate process that has to be initiated if a supervisor wants to lay a criminal charge. Secondly, the concern on private residences and the fact that this section refers to any premises. I think this section needs to be read in the context of the section, this subsection needs to be read in the context of the section as a whole. For a private residence to be inspected, there are four factors that need to be met. The first is that the residence must be used as a business for which the FIC Act provides in the schedule to the FIC Act. It must be used for the business of an accountable institution. Otherwise, it's outside of the realm of the FIC Act. There's no reason to inspect it. Secondly, and this is in subsection 45.1b, the grounds on which a warrant may be issued apply to a private residence. Firstly, that there's a suspicion that non-compliance has occurred, so there must be some information put before a judicial officer to get that warrant, that the entry is necessary to find that evidence, and that the entry is necessary to apply the FIC Act to that non-compliance. And those same grounds would apply where the inspection is done without a warrant, because the warrant is an exception to this general rule. So the same grounds would still have to be applied. You still have to believe that you would meet these requirements if you had gone through the process of obtaining the warrant. Otherwise, the exercise of the warrantless inspection would have been beyond the scope of the powers that the Act provides for the inspector. So in looking at 1C, one should read it in the context of the section as a whole, and not simply look at the wording of 1C, but understand also that all those grounds that are provided for inspecting private residences in 1B apply in the case where an inspector moves under 1C. The next element raised in the referral letter is that the purpose for which this warrant is, or this exception to a warrant requirement is in the legislation can be achieved by other means. And the purpose, the assumption here is that the purpose is to to enable an inspector to launch a surprise attack on the inspected party. In other words, to arrive there unannounced and catch the institution sort of red-handed, for want of a better word. And then that can be achieved by getting the warrant without prior notice to the inspected party. But I think that what's missed here is that the purpose of this deviation from the warrant requirement is not necessarily to launch a surprise attack. It's to avoid a delay in the process, frustrating the reason for the inspection. So it's a delay issue, not the surprise factor. All warrants are obtained ex parte. A warrant is applied for in chambers with a judicial officer. There's never prior notice to the inspected party. They only become aware of the warrant when the warrant is executed, and at that point they can stop the process and then go and contest the issuing of the warrant. But they're never given forewarning that the warrant is going to be applied for. So I think that doesn't solve the problem of dealing with a delay issue, which is what this, at least one element of this exception is trying to achieve. So it's not a correct match with the purpose of the section. And then just lastly, the last ground that was pointed out in the letter is that the breadth of the other provisions in the legislation, particularly those that deal with prominent persons and the massive amount of information that the institutions have to obtain on those persons as their customers, requires careful scrutiny of the rest of the bill. And I think that point is accepted, but I think it needs to be understood that the inspection is not about obtaining evidence or information about the customer of an institution. An inspector can't go and inquire and tell me about this customer of yours. The inspection is about the institution's compliance with its obligations, not investigating the institution's customers. And again, that would exceed the legality of the inspection if an inspector were to do that. So that's in a nutshell, briefly, our stance on the concerns pointed out in the letter. We are in the process of discussing these with legal counsel as well. Those opinions and so forth have not been finalized yet, but when they are settled, we will obviously avail them to the committee as well.
And Pinky.
Chair, hopefully we've got the right place. Chair, I think the two presentations have gone into the detail, and as you know, I'm not a lawyer, so I'm not going to go and into I think, the technical legal arguments that clearly the committee needs to look at. What I was going to do, and I don't mind waiting if you want to discuss their presentation, is just a broader context and the other pressures and perhaps some of the process issues that we face, like the need to get this through quickly and just to explain the context. So I leave it to you. If you want me to wait, I'm happy to.
They're related in a way.
Okay.
So they're separate. We're not going to look, I don't know. I think it's fine unless members object. Just do it. How long you want?
Okay.
A few minutes, please, right?
Yeah. Okay. Yes. Go ahead. Yeah, but
why don't we just go through and say where's your submission?
Yeah.
You don't have
hard copy. I thought they around, but I don't know.
Do you have any hard copy?
Okay. Have you got it in front of you? Okay, Chair, so look, I won't go through the first slide, which is the background. But I think just to make the obvious point that anti-money laundering, we're not doing this because of any international institution like FATF. We're doing it because, obviously, of South Africa's commitment to the fight against corruption and to make it harder for criminals to use bank secrecy and cross-border illicit flows, you know, to keep the proceeds of those crimes. I was just reading yesterday that the Nigerian government is still trying to get $1 billion from Swiss and European banks related to Sani Abacha. So it's that kind of thing. It also reduces tax revenue, so we certainly have a direct interest in the matter. Just to remind members, when we brought the FIC Amendment Bill, the issue was really to update the 2001 Act. Firstly, you know, things get modernized and changed and there's better sharing of info, so we wanted to deal with this. Where to deal with the constitutional issue, where to update for newer standards that emerged after the bill had been passed related to politically exposed persons, beneficial ownership, for example, and to make it easier on the customer, because the current approach that we have is not risk-based. So if you have a risk-based approach, it should actually bring down the burden of many customers and the complaints we have in how things are implemented. Also, I think, just before that, I think an important point to note is we have decided to meet standards set by international bodies like FATF because we want to be able to conduct transactions with the rest of the world. Go on holiday, you need to use your credit card, well, we better be compliant. Otherwise, those things don't happen. Okay? So this bill is clearly important and I think to make a point, because there's been a lot of said in the press, the issue of you're not convicted and so on. The idea about corruption is to take preventive action. And that is the UN Convention Against Corruption that Kofi Annan led. And that's something to be understood, that this becomes a legitimate tool to fight corruption even before people get convicted, because you're taking, because it's preventive. The focus is on dealing, as okay, we've dealt with a lot of this, let's move on to the next one. So, Chair, what are the kind of deadlines that we've had to meet with this bill, just to remind ourselves? The first deadline was, of course, that set by the Constitutional Court, which gave us, I think, till February this year. Effectively, obviously, we brought the bill in late, so it certainly wasn't the fault of the committee, it was our fault, and the fact that the bill obviously was not enacted just meant that since February the warrantless searches provision could not really be applied by the FIC and the regulators. The other deadline that we have is related to FATF. And Chair, we will be distributing, so just so that you can see, the last mutual evaluation report on South Africa. In fact, when we went, and I went, you know, after the bill, sort of, to FATF meeting in the South Korea in July. And you'll see there that they, in fact, if you remember, we had been served all kinds of yellow cards where the president of FATF wanted to first visit the minister because the bill had still not been through cabinet. Secondly, he wanted to visit, after we published the bill, he wanted to visit the chair of yourself and Mr. De Beer to make sure that, to try and see if the bill could be processed faster or whatever, or to make you aware of the issues, okay? But I think they were happy enough that we passed it quickly enough. And in fact, when we went to the June meeting, they thought, okay, this is real progress. And you'll see in that note, it will say that we had to report by September to complete the process and to start implementing. But they were sort of so happy with the progress made by the two houses that in that meeting, they changed the September deadline to February. So when we go to the meeting in February, and they said that you need to take two further steps that were outstanding. First, it's the assent by the president, and second, it's putting in place the regulations and getting the act into being. So that certainly required quite a lot of work for us to prepare the regs, which is quite a process. And we have to go back in February and report. Obviously, we will go and do the best we can to explain the constitutional issues. And the action we want to prevent, this sounds like another ratings exercise, is to make sure that they don't issue a public statement to admonish us, in effect, and implying that we are non-compliant and risky to this jurisdiction for AML-CFT deficiencies. So it's certainly in our interest as South Africa to comply with these standards, because if we don't, other countries will be less likely to provide information, and we should know this. We have lots of people who have left this country, some go to Australia. When we try and get that information through the money laundering authorities, if we don't meet standards, they're not going to give it to us. So it's in our interest to make sure we do have these international standards and agreements. And therefore, we can't deal with problems like illicit flows. Because most money laundering, when people take when they want to take their proceeds into another country so you can't touch them, it just becomes more difficult. International transactions will be, if not impossible, I don't want to scare people, but they'll certainly be harder and more expensive, as overseas regulators will not place reliance on our institutions, so you have to get correspondent banking links with overseas banks. And if you want to hear stories, I can tell you about how that's happened in Iran. It's happened in many countries that don't meet those standards. We don't want to get there. The FATF can certainly terminate back again. Sorry, I'll tell you right. You know, one section could be that they could terminate our membership if we are not compliant, but that's an extreme step. We certainly don't want to go there. So we believe we must resolve the constitutional issues arising as soon as possible so that the bill can be signed into the law and the regulations put in place. And certainly when we go in February, we'll argue for a bit more time, but to have a sense of the time we would need, I think, would be very useful. Chair, just to make the obvious point, since the bill was passed, yes, there's been a lot said in the media and so on. So we've had our own process to prepare for implementation after the NCOP adopted the bill around the end of May. We've had meetings with stakeholders involved with the regulations. And we've also noticed people didn't approach us, but it was out in the media that there were letters of objection from the Progressive Professionals Forum and the Black Business Council. We met, for example, with the Black Business Council. And though we have their letters where they say that not just this provision, a lot of the bill is unconstitutional, there's no legal opinion that's actually put there. And we ask them for their legal opinion. We still await that from some of the parties. We were then informed, like you, on the 29th of November, that the President has sent us back. And, of course, the document that we have is the letter that where the President outlines. We don't have any other document, just for the record, so you know that. I won't go into the legal issues because people better than I have already raised these issues. You can move on. I think in terms of process, Chair, since you had asked us, this provision, in fact, was there from pretty early on, from 2014 almost, because we took the wording of the Constitutional Court. We've got the legal opinions at that stage from the Chief State Law Advisor, which we could, I think we did make it available, we could make that available. And, you know, the bill has been through the executive, through several cabinet committees. It's been effectively approved by cabinet twice, firstly for public comment in April, if I remember last year, and then later in September for tabling. And so that clause has stayed, and from my recollection, it actually didn't get changed at all by the committee. So it sort of stayed as is. So there were no provisions during the process, even before it came to Parliament and in Parliament, where that was noted as a concern. Which doesn't mean there's no concern. It's just to outline the process. Move on. Okay. So, Chair, you can move on these as well. This is just for information for our commitments. Move on. I think I've, just last slide. I think, you know, when we've gone out, some people have said to us, no, why are we listening to standards outside? We've pointed out that, as I said earlier, firstly, we always start with this is in our interest, in our own sovereign interest. And once we determine something's in our interest, obviously there are standards, and this is how we play. Some people have asked us, but you know, why should we stay in FATF? Well, we point out, even if you leave FATF, those standards still apply to us. And it's like Brexit then, where you can leave, but your commitments to Europe stay, but you won't be on the table, even if it's a small vote that you may have, to actually say, hold on, we don't like these standards, that's the impact. And I want to say, South Africa is in fact championing the whole issue that because these standards today are implemented by private financial institutions, you are finding many banks, especially in the US and other advanced economies, are cutting their correspondent banking links because they want to de-risk with many African countries, many poor countries. We've taken this issue up in a big way. It hasn't affected us directly, but we've been in FATF, we've been in other forums, and this issue has certainly been prioritized. So it's very important, I think, not just for South Africa, but for the continent's sake, that we actually stay in these forums so that we can argue the case and bring this to the attention of the world. So I'll stop there, Chair, just to give the broad overview.
Thank you. And Mr. Main.
Thank you, Chair. Chair, I think we should move from a premise as a committee that says this is one most important legislation that we all want to see implemented, because it will deal with the issues that have been topical, your money laundering, your illicit flows, and all other related issues, corruption and all those other related issues. And as the ANC, those are things that are very critical to us. But also, we also want to assure Momo that, you know, we want to be part of and participate in those international bodies as South Africa. But these international bodies must not forget that we are a developing country. They must not treat us like we are developed. We are also coming, and we really want to be there, and we don't want you to be deregistered from FATF and all those other bodies, because we want to also have clean governance, and we want to attract foreign direct investment if it's part of the things that will also assist us as we deal with some of these things. But Chair, and I've seen the presentation, and like you normally say, we are not technically empowered to deal with some of these things. And thanks for the intervention that we have, Advocate Jenkins, to assist us from time to time on other things. But from when FIC was presenting and looking at some of the deviations that we want to do, because for lack of a better word, I call it deviation from the Criminal Procedure Act, which he was saying, and all those things. I think, and I'm speaking on behalf of the ANC because I'm a member there.
Not
that
on behalf.
I'm making this proposal to the ANC because I'm a member, Chair, that I will want us to have our own study group and reflect on this thing so that when we come and make this presentation or come back and make inputs here, we shall have reflected on some of these things. Because I know, and this is an unfortunate situation, Chair, and I'll give a very bad example. And you know, there's an idiom that says, once bitten, twice shy. You know, Treasury has been in very unfortunate situations, and I'll give an example of SARS and FIC and them. You know, you don't know whether when you do some of these things, there might be, we are human, that's what Mazambani said at some point. You know, people will also want to use some of these things, unfortunately, whether political or fighting other battles and so on, like we have seen in SARS and all those things. So now my proposal is that from the ANC side, I'm putting this on the table to say, let's go and consult amongst ourselves and get the technical legal advice around this thing. But also, when we come back and meet, let some of the supervisory bodies that are listed here come. The Registrar of the Bank, the FSB, the FIC, because these are critical bodies that also are part of this legislation in one way or the other. So let them also be there so that we have, when we deal with this thing holistically, everybody's here, and including SARS, because some of these things SARS has to deal with. So that by the time we make those inputs, everybody knows where we are going. Thank you.
Mania, and then Mr. Kwang Kwang.
Thank you, Chair. I just have two proposals and two questions. My two proposals are as follows. The first is that Advocate Jenkins states in his letter that the committee may request any documents that pertain to the President's reservations in terms of its general powers to request evidence in terms of Section 56 of the Constitution. I would formally propose that this committee agrees to request the President to discover all the documents relevant to his reservations and which were used in determining that the provisions in the bill were unconstitutional. So that is the first proposal. I think our deliberations would benefit from insight into those documents. So that's my first formal proposal. My second formal proposal, Chair, is that this committee receive an independent legal opinion on whether the provisions are in fact unconstitutional, and if in fact the legal opinion that we receive determines that they are unconstitutional, in other words, agrees with the President's reservations, that they propose how those defects be remedied. The reason I say that with respect is the state law advisor certified the bill as constitutional. National Treasury evidently believed the bill was constitutional, and with respect to Parliament, Parliament believed that the bill was constitutional and still holds that view, and that view may be valid. I just think in these circumstances,
we're going to get senior counsel. I've started the process. In fact, we've been asked to go ahead.
Great.
I told you.
Well, I wasn't aware that you...
I told you this twice.
No, you mentioned...
I told you last week that you might have to go to three, remember? You know, the problem with Parliament is that you have to have three options. I've consulted Cedric again, so it's nothing major or outlandish to say, yes, we have to get senior counsel.
Good. Well, then we've agreed. My first proposal then still needs to be agreed to.
But the senior counsel thing, I've started that process.
Great.
What else am I supposed to do as a chair? There's no choice about it. Can people focus on the legal issues, really? Because that's what's at hand. The only issue is this provision unconstitutional or constitutional? We can deal with the other issues, but what we have to decide is how we proceed. Am I right? We can only discuss this issue of we can explain the context and the policies and so on, but there's a simple issue here. Am I right? Can you guide me? It is about one provision. We do not have the authority, as you explained, to start opening up everything again. That can come by way of a bill from the executive. As far as I know, to save time, and that's why, Momo, maybe you shouldn't have made that input. We must just focus on the issue at hand. There's only one thing. Can somebody rule me out of order then? The issue is simply this. There is a provision the president finds, or his lawyers do at least, unconstitutional. It is that single provision. Basically, to summarize, it's warrantless searches. What we've established doesn't come from us. It came from the very same cabinet which the president leads. So we didn't do anything. I saw something in today's paper, Linda, saying Parliament, I don't mean to assault you, so to speak, but you're a buddy of ours, and mine in particular. I'm just saying, I thought you said the committee, the way it appeared to me, at least in a cursory reading, was that the committee made this amendment to meet the... We actually didn't. It's the executive that did so. As far as I know, both Mr. Jenkins and Momo confirm that that provision is exactly more or less what it was when the cabinet...
I haven't read the report, so I don't know how...
Yeah. Well, we didn't do anything. So now the cabinet, well, at least the president who heads the cabinet, has now decided it's unconstitutional.
Well,
there's nothing wrong with the president now deciding, or his lawyers deciding it's unconstitutional, but it's not our bill. It's not our provision. You came with it, right? And we left it more or less untouched. So the issue is simple here. It is... Now that we are where we are, and given the joint rules of Parliament, which Gwankwa and others can go and change, there's a simple question. What do we do now with this one provision? As I understand what you are saying, Mr. Jenkins, that's all we have to look at. And we have to take into account submissions made to us, there's two so far, from CASAC and from PPF, right? Each of this can be entertained to the extent it deals with a particular clause at issue. Beyond that, Parliament could suggest to the executive, can we, that look, maybe you need to look at the bill again, though it's interesting, we just finished the bill in May. What has happened between May and now that we would want to change the bill? That's another thing members will have to justify to a committee chair, never mind which party you come from. As far as I know, the ANC started with no position on the matter. We're just brainstorming here. And so people should speak for themselves within the context of the parties they come from, but there's no ANC position. And then there's a chair. I don't care where the chair comes from. He or she must abide by the rules of Parliament. If you are unhappy with the rules, go and change the rules. I've said that to parties, including my own. So the chair has got no choice. Can you advise me, Advocate Jenkins, is that the only issue at hand at the moment?
Yes,
Chair. There's nothing else we have to discuss.
Just
then members can come with their other ideas about whether they think FATF is an imperialist conspiracy. Where do they think, hey, let's jettison this whole thing and go the North Korea route? That's fine. The ANC must discuss that at its policy conference in July next year. I'm not saying anybody's saying that. I'm just saying that we must actually be clear that the chair has got no choice about it. The chair has got no choice. In other words, where we're sitting here, we'll have to do the same, right? So one proposal we may want to make to Parliament is to change the rules. So can we focus on the issue? What do we do about this unconstitutional, so to speak, provision? How are we going to proceed? What are the options? The one thing that I've already started working on, I might not have spoken to you, Pule, but you would have done the same, is to seek independent senior counsel opinion. I have conferred with the authorities concerned, the House Chair, on two occasions, And in an exchange with you last week, I did tell you, when we were talking about the FSR bill, that on this matter, we will have to get senior counsel. And so I'm doing that anyway, because I have to do it. All I want you to do is endorse it today, because there'd be no case to say, don't get a senior counsel opinion.
Chair, can we then take my proposal to request the presidency to discover documents that pertain to his reservation? Can we take that as agreed to? Or
no, we'll discuss all the proposals.
Okay. Okay. Two questions. First of all, one factual. I wonder if the FIC could tell us how many warrantless searches they've actually conducted in the, would it be 3, possibly 4 years prior to the Constitutional Court ruling that they were unconstitutional. So how many warrantless searches have actually been conducted? The second question, I just wanted you to understand this. You said earlier, before we started this matter, Chairperson, and this is a question to you, I think everybody appreciates that there is an element of urgency in this matter, not least because of the looming FATF deadline. And there was an appetite to try to deal with this, as you yourself said, by today. I wonder if you could just be specific, if you could just tell us why that was not possible in your deliberations with the powers that be in Parliament. I credit you with trying to achieve that goal, but I just want to understand what were the impediments.
Banker, I can put it on record.
Well, thank you. Thank you, Chair. Sorry if you discussed my question at an earlier meeting. But I also want to get a sense, before I take this matter back to my caucus, what are the frustrations? What is the average amount of time it takes you to obtain a warrant? Are there any delays? What were the frustrations? What were the problems and so on? Before we start talking about warrantless searches. The issue that, it's indeed true, Chairperson. Thus, this matter needs to be taken back to our caucus as political parties so that we can talk about it, deliberate on it, because we too need to obtain our own legal opinion so that we can get advice be guided on the matter. From where I'm sitting, for example, as an ordinary member of South African, an ordinary member of the public, not a leader of a political party, the issue around warrantless searches seems like you're giving too much power to an institution, because then it might, as it was mentioned earlier on, what do you do then when the institution falls into the wrong hands? Remember, Chairperson, I want to caution, I think we usually sometimes talk about the powers of the President and we say maybe when we, started our democratic process in the, at the beginning, we legislated for Madiba for the honeymoon period. Now my concern is that you see, even though these issues, when I heard us debating this matter in the House, that's what I want to say yesterday, there are a lot of conspiracy theories, around the President wanting to protect his or certain individuals. But when I look at it, it would be legitimate concerns for any parliament or any institutions to look at when you're trying to set up an institution or give powers to an institution. So you mustn't treat it with reservation or with suspicion because these are coming from President Zuma, even when they are indeed right. It's important for Parliament to look into this thing and make sure that we do it properly. Not just for us, but for future generations as well. Thank you.
Okay. More comments on what we do about this and how we proceed. Then we can deal with the other issues, the more policy issues. Sifiso?
Chair, this is definitely something which we have effects on the wider society, community, and so on. And I don't think it's something that we can finalize here today. I think I'd like to align myself with Pinky and Kwanka that let's take this matter back to our caucuses. We'd like to also get a proper guidance. But if I were to be educated, what happens if we take this bill as it is back to the President and it still has the same view? So I'm just saying that more haste, less speed. We shouldn't be rushing this thing because we find that we are getting delayed more and more. The very fact that the President must sign is
not just a pipeline. It means he must apply his mind and come to a certain determination, and that he has done. So I think it's also very important that we factor that one in. So I would like to align myself with both Nkwankwa and Comrade Pinky.
I think I just wanted to emphasize the point that has already been made by Honorable Kwangwa and Pinky, and I think Sfiso is moving along those lines as well. But I think most importantly is to also get the legal team from Parliament to also advise us on the kind of sort of time frames we have. Because from the different presentations that are coming up, it's quite clear that this also has got a bearing or implication on a number of other legislative undertakings that they've got to take. That even if we were to agree on a process, surely we would not have done sufficient work today deliberating for the first time on a matter that came back when it was referred by the President back to us to try and look at the things that we're already deliberating on. The issue of the time frame, because I'm sure that when I was conferring with the Chair, I did come to understand that certain of the things are actually prescribed in the Constitution, especially including the time period set out for you to deal with a bill when it has been referred back to Parliament.
There's a joint rule that says what you can do, as it's
yes,
not
yes.
the Constitution.
Yes, or it's not a constitutional issue.
As far as I
know. Oh, okay. Yes, yes, yeah.
I'm
trying to establish that so that even if parties go to their different caucuses to do work, we know that this is the time through which we need to come back and at least have a resolve on this thing. Otherwise, if we don't, it might as well become a protracted process on its own. So that was just my submission, Chair.
Fine.
Chair, I think it's clear that we need to go back to reconsider the provisions that are deemed to be unconstitutional. And as we do so as parties, also take into account what David is suggesting, to look at documentation that says the provisions are unconstitutional, so that when you apply your mind as parties, you zoom into that specific one. But then also let's consider also, because we have been advised by our legal advisor, let's get another opinion so that we can juxtapose our parliamentary opinion, the government opinion, and an independent opinion. That will help us to formulate a position that maybe can be reconsidered within the stipulated time frames and frameworks that we need to work this out, meaning that if the rules say that, I'm not sure about the specific rule that gives us time to look at this, because we must also take into account the fact that we as Parliament did not change a specific provision. So we need to give National Treasury an opportunity to re-look at that provision, because we did not make changes to it, and we will then consider their opinion on those things. So let's take a holistic approach when we look at that, and when we come back we can start to discuss this, including taking decisions on whether we're going to take further public hearings, because this matter is attracting more public opinion. So we will also look at what the rule says in relation to that, as to whether can we reopen public hearings and have them, or can we as the committee proceed, and that's where Advocate Jenkins must come in, that when there was a legislation returned by the president being unconstitutional, what then was the processes that followed in terms of reconsidering those pieces of legislation? Was the process reopened for public hearing, or did the committee just consider that as is and move forward? So that's what we will look into. So, Chair, to make you chair an interactive process in terms of how you're going to formulate the problem that will relate to the discussion.
Members, Mr. Mania again.
Chair, we'll obviously at some point you'll bring us back to my proposal. I want to make another proposal. That we've just looked at the parliamentary program, that we amend the program in the first term to ensure that we've in fact followed the relevant processes and dealt with this bill so that the House can debate it. I think the earliest date would be the 21st of February, which is the day before the budget debate.
All right,
and that would, as I understand, I wanted to just check with Momo that if the bill was then debated and sent to the presidency on the 21st, it would be within the FATF deadline. Is that correct or incorrect?
So can I have a follow-up question on this?
Yeah.
David, this is not a money bill, right? So therefore there is no agency to debate it before the budget. If it was, for instance, the FSR bill, then we could have debated it before the budget because there's budget implications. But this one is not a money bill. So we shouldn't predetermine at what point. Let's give the chair to decide the date. And we'll adopt the program as and when he presents. I don't know, Chair, because you said it's the last day. These are the reasons why I said this shouldn't be the last day. Because I had to consider that we needed to change the program on the basis of the FICP. But, you know, the powers that might be changed the situation.
It's just a comment, for instance. I want to say, following up from the point I made about us or trying to caution us not to make laws for President Zuma, as an example, is that look at these warrantless searches. By just looking at it, for instance, sitting from opposition benches, it could very easily work against us in future. What stops this institution, it falls into the wrong hands, from these people from using it to victimize those businesses that are sympathetic to our cause?
Yes.
Right? So we must not be short-sighted here and only think that it's about chasing certain individuals. It's about general application and making sure that everyone is treated fairly. Obviously, I can't discuss it because it still needs to be debated in the caucus of the UDL. But I'm just making an example that we must look at this point holistically. You know,
Mr. Kwanko, you were not here. We discussed all these issues quite thoroughly. There's nothing unique about this provision. It's there in the SARS, and it's warrantless searches under exceptional circumstances are the norms in the Criminal Procedure Act and so on. If you watch any Hollywood movie or you watch a Nollywood movie or a Bollywood movie, in other words, or watch a Brazilian movie, it's all over the world, warrantless searches. So we have discussed all these issues, right? Can I just raise this thing about procedure? I'm chairing now. Now, all of these issues were discussed a few months ago. What has happened since then to open up the issue, except we should separate the policy issue from the constitutionality issue? The policy issue is clear. Warrantless searches are warranted. I mean, you're not a lawyer, but you sound a lot like a lawyer. Sorry, I forgot you're not a lawyer. Warrantless searches are warranted. The point of parliaments all over the world is to circumscribe the circumstances in which they occur. It is impossible, actually, to deal with crimes of certain types unless you provide for warrantless searches. The issue is, if you say no to warrantless searches in principle, you will have to undo a lot of the laws post-1994, including all the SARS things. So you're raising like a fundamental issue. Shouldn't the issue be, under what circumstances should warrantless searches apply, and exactly whom should carry it out, and what should be the protection a person has against abuse? Now, you will have read in the paper every now and then, even SARS gets challenged in a court of law, And sometimes people's property is returned and so on because of unprocedural. So I think we must be very clear what we are doing here. We are not raising the policy issue. The issues are around the constitutionality. Right? So I am directing this committee now, as I'm required to do by my deployment for now in this position, to deal with the matter at hand. And the matter at hand is this. The president's lawyers have found that that provision of warrantless searches is unconstitutional. Our job today in the first instance is to decide how we proceed from here on the matter. That's our issue. We can have our party political positions on what the process should be, but there are some aspects that, whether one belongs to one party or another, there are rules that define what you have to do. Now, in anticipation of a response to the Progressive Professionals Forum, which letter you all have, I asked Advocate Jenkins, they're wanting to have a submission, oral submission, the point Tandi is raising. Can we allow for oral submissions? If you look at the last sentence which was sent to you of his letter, it says that the committee, Advocate Jenkins, am I right, the committee must decide for itself whether it wants to have written submissions and or oral submissions, but they have to apply to the issue of whether the particular clause is constitutional or not. Am I right? That is in the letter, Tandi. So our decision is, should we have oral hearings? Should we have written hearings? The answer is provided by this committee. We have never denied anybody. I'm ruling, I'm chairing. And you must rule me out of order and show me why I'm wrong. I am saying to you, this committee has only now, last week, had people make submissions. Why now suddenly must we say no to the professional? What PPF? Or CASAC, whoever wants to come. So the committee must, what party political caucus is required for that? This committee has since July 2014 said that people are free to come to this parliament. This is their parliament. If the PPF has a problem with the bill, that is their right. They must focus on the issue at hand. If CASAC has something, they must come. Whoever wants to come should come to parliament. The issue that we must decide on now is, do we have only written submissions? Do we have written and oral as one aspect of the... can I finish, please? For one aspect of the process. Two, if we do not decide today, what would we do on the 24th of January? We'll convene again and say, well, although this committee has allowed anybody and everybody to speak here, this time around we're deciding against that process. And as a majority, you can decide against it, but I'll be interested to know why. Why now suddenly we're saying no to people? Let them have their voices heard. What is there to discuss, in my view? Beyond that, each party can say, and on the appointment of a senior counsel, I am answerable to the Speaker's office in any case. I've discussed it with the representative Speaker's office. We have to have independent senior counsel. I've activated that process. So the second issue is there disagreement on the appointment of a senior counsel? The third issue is, beyond looking at this particular issue, are there other issues we want to raise? And that's a matter more for party political caucuses. That's a matter I think each study group should meet and discuss. But on the matter of process, I'm very confused if we're saying we shouldn't have some sort of public engagement around it, one. And two, that actually we should employ senior counsel. Those are the two issues only before us. The rest we can discuss. Thirdly, I don't think we should be bound by an FATF stipulation. It will not be the end of the world, surely, Momo, if we did it before the end of the first quarter. What would be the problem? On the separate matters about the relationship between our sovereignty and FATF and all, those are separate issues that we can come to, and party political caucus can decide those things. Except that you have to now argue a case differently now from what you did. I entirely agree with you, Mr. Kwankwa. It's not a question of how people see the presidency. It's simply a question of, are there merits in the argument or not? And it's not something we as MPs can decide, surely. Lawyers have to advise us in that regard. My responses yesterday in the debate, I don't know what all the hoo-ha is about in the media, quite frankly, was in response to the EFF that is presenting it as if somehow the ANC and the study group here will be supine and just accept it. No, I repeat what I said, as any chair would. I repeat. The fact that the president's lawyers have found this provision unconstitutional does not per se make it unconstitutional. Parliament must come to its own independent legal opinion. And we've got three choices. One, as I see it, we say, we don't agree with your president, and refer it back to him, in which case he has the choice, after we explain why we don't agree with his lawyers, to refer it to the Constitutional Court if he so wants. Or, I don't know what else he can do, but maybe at the Jenkins, you can have us. That's one. Two is, we can delete this provision altogether and continue with the bill. Or three is, we amend it to take account of all the provisions. Those are the only three options available to us. We can have our party caucus decide on that later. But I can't see why we can't decide on a simple thing. One, is that yes, we allow public submissions. Two, let's appoint an independent counsel. What caucus meeting do you need for that sort of thing? And why suddenly? Then we must take a rule here now that we've changed our whole philosophy. From now on, no bill do we just allow anybody and everybody to come till the last stages. So those are the issues before us. On the remaining issues, you can get party political caucuses, really. Those are policy positions. But on this issue, this is what is before us. Why do you have to wait till 6 weeks from now to decide on those two things, at least? Thank you. I'm done for now.
May I respond to you? I think I need to say that I use the term warrantless searches in the context of what is in front of us from the president. And then in your later input, you highlighted obviously the challenges with making sure that there's some kind of limitation. Remember, even this presentation says the problem is that the mandate is, or the discretion is overly broad, which is what we must address. I thought, so my point was saying, here when it comes to legislation and important issues, I think as politicians we must tread carefully. There is no, I made that point. The point about us now making legislation for President Zuma is the impression that was given to members of the public during this debate yesterday. I followed it attentively. I was listening to the inputs of various political parties. Others implied it and so on. But I'm saying for political parties across the board, I think to some extent we may have misled the public. That is the point I'm trying to make. Now we have an opportunity to apply our minds as a committee and come to a different conclusion. The point you're making about the process, I thought they were going to run concurrently. Parties do follow their own processes, and portfolio committees, obviously, we also do, and follow our own process to make sure that we conclude this matter sooner rather than later. I thought we had concluded that point earlier. Thank you.
On the matter of having public hearings restricted to this matter, and two, on the independent counsel being appointed, what's your objection?
No, there has never been an objection, Chair, and I don't think there's any member who would object to that. It has been our practice to allow people. We even extended up to the last minute to allow those who wanted to. So there's nobody who says there shouldn't be. In fact, I'm saying the way we're dealing with it, whether oral or written, let's allow them both as a committee. Including, and you said it so eloquently, including the FIC, who are saying there's technical legal advice that we can also source from our side. And I thought that's what informed our decision some days ago to say, let's get a senior counsel. And we are in full support of that, you see.
Thanks, Chair. I think... With your wealth of experience, having been in here in Parliament for a while, it's coming quite helpful, especially the fact that there are already certain legislations which might also need at a different level their own special attention, because the experience in South Africa has been that these things could be easily abused. You know, so yeah, I'm just saying we don't live in a distant village. We stay here. You know, and they are sometimes used wrongly by the same people who are proponents of those same laws. So, you know, it's 20 years is enough for us to know which kind of laws are necessary or the kind of trajectory we should be taking to protect the right of all citizens, regardless of whatever political divide they stand on. Because it doesn't matter. You know, I'm sure the basis of the existence of the different political parties is that they too will want to rise and be in power one day. So, and I agree with Honorable Nkwangwa that if you look at the legislative undertakings and want to say no, you only think that you are resolving a Zuma problem and forget that this might come to bite you later on when you are in power. And I'm sure that the DA with the little 100 days experience of Johannesburg, they might have seen as well that laws are laws. You know, when they are put in, you can't just change them. You know, if laws of this country prescribe certain things, you don't win power tomorrow and think that people will, and you know, you can't do that. You can't, if the ANC has fought xenophobia, you can't come into power and begin advocating something that instigating xenophobic conduct. You can't. So I'm just giving this as some side examples. But also, Chair, I agree that I felt the point you have made that public participation is an important cornerstone of our participatory democracy. But also say, maybe make a suggestion that even as we subject some of these things to a public participation of some sort, we try and make sure, because we have had an instance where we had public, I think it was on, was it on the skills levy, where you find that unless you would easily direct the issues that are brought before you, you sometimes might deal with a very large or new views that are being brought about. While you allow people to bring those, but you also need to try and focus them on the issue that is before us, Chair. I think that is also quite important. So it means that the legal team in Parliament would also have to synchronize the real issue that we are dealing with, including trying to talk to some of the legal opinions that we have already received, so that even as we entertain those public participation processes, we are also able to bring to members of the public the Parliament process and where we are. Thanks, Chair.
Mr. Momo, yeah, you asked me a question. Oh, Thandi, and then I'll respond. Yeah, she's on first because I remember she does. But I want to respond to something else you raised.
I think you misconstrued my point when I said let's check the procedures about how we're going to go about rediscussing this issue. That's why I said let's check what the rules are saying. So I didn't make any suggestion by any chance to me that people should not come for public hearing.
No, I wasn't saying that.
No, in case, I'm just...
No, I'm
trying to clear the air.
No, yeah,
you know, yesterday in the chamber, somebody said that somebody's blood was going to the head. So I don't want to huff and puff on this one. I want to be very careful. So I think the approach is going to be clear. How we going? I just wanted to reconfirm that we're going to take a senior council advice, because it's imperative, and then get all the necessary documentation for consideration to the matter. Lest we find ourselves engaging in the current conjuncture with the aspects that you want to discuss later. You know, when we're hot under the heels trying to make a point, at a very early stage, and then find ourselves later having to subject ourselves to legal prescripts. So I'm just passing that as a homework.
People to Frank's letter, because Frank wrote the letter to me, because I'm going to attach it to my replies to the people who've asked to make oral and or written submissions. Okay, so that letter is quite clear if colleagues will pay attention, because it saves us a lot of time. The letter was sent to people, I think, 48 hours ago. Now, Mr. Mania asked me, why didn't you do your best or whatever? Why didn't it work out? What happened? Well, he knows. He should know by now. I spoke to him about the FSR. And in that context, I mentioned to him, he might have forgotten, that the problem with getting senior counsel by, you said, can we meet Comrade Sifiso? If you could kindly pay attention, do you mind? Because then I don't want to cover this ground again. So if people can listen, it'll help. Look. In engaging with Mr. Mania on the FSR bill, he wanted us to meet, I think, on Thursday afternoon and certainly Friday morning, you will recall. So I had to tell him, I have spoken to Mr. Frolich, Mr. Bengu, and who else did I consult? I think I spoke to Frank to find out how fast you can appoint a senior counsel and so on. The original response I got was, that you can't just appoint a senior counsel, okay? Members, people pay attention to this sort of thing because, hey, I'm 60 and you're 21, right? So, you know, this is what happens. So you ask, do you, well, you know, he should really join the ANC, I mean, I don't see much difference between his thinking and ours. So really, you know, how long are you going to remain outside there? No, you should also join the ANC, properly, I mean. Ah, yeah, Mr. Mania. So here it is. I think one of them said to me, you need to get three senior counsel and then, Parliament must look at it and so on. I told you all this. I don't know why you're asking me this question. It's not a sort of thing Linda or somebody is going to write about, but anyway, I told you all this. It takes a lot of time to talk on the phone. Yes, I do it while I'm driving, but still I could speak to other people. So I told you what happens, right? Then you will recall, on Wednesday night, I went back and we said we'll confer on Thursday. But I can tell you now the ANC comrades have told me they're not likely to come on Friday. Tandi and I will be there if we have to. Fine. Then, Mr. Frolich told me in no uncertain terms that he will not be able to sign off on the senior council. I'm even told that the STP, is that correct, Frank? Secretary of Parliament doesn't like us appointing senior council. He says must use internal, except in a case like this, right? So you can't, I told you, we can't get by Friday or even next week, to repeat what I said to you, a senior counsel from our side, point one. Point two, I told you that, in fact, these guys, Treasury, have gone to a senior counsel, and they were hoping on Monday the earliest they'll get a response, and yesterday I discovered that you still don't have your final response from senior counsel. You also, Tandi, they've also got senior counsel, right? Then I explained to you that even if we voted on the bill, by today, let's say. Although they told me today is out, right? They said if there's any prospect, it has to be on Tuesday. So I said, fine, if we can do it, but what would be the point? I told you also what I think is very important. If we were to rush this thing, it will imply to people who have an interest in this that we are just doing this nominally. You know, we're going through the motions. We're not paying it any attention. And it's actually, I think, almost bordering, I didn't use this term, I'm telling you now, insolence on the part of, not from this committee, at least not while I'm here. We must consult. People must have a right to speak. This is their parliament, whoever they are, right? You know, there's a lady that turns up here representing nobody, it seems, but herself. We've never stopped her. I've even tried to get funding for her to come, remember, Alan? And we couldn't get funding. So people should be allowed to be here. And I thought we're rushing the process. But I want to make something also clear, Momo. We've raised this with you in our report to Parliament, and Pinky raised it in the House yesterday. It's a broader issue that we need to apply our mind to. Yes, yes, we are part of a globalized financial system. Yes, yes, we need investment and we need jobs. Yes, yes, many of these things are good for us. But we also have to recognize that we're a developing country, we're in a particular phase in our emerging democracy, and we need to adapt and adjust these rules. I remain, I'm speaking for myself now as a chair, convinced that it's not the end of the world if we do not finish this process. But when is your FATF meeting, by the way? What date? Yeah. You know what? I'm saying to you, that shouldn't be the guideline. There is no crime in saying to them, we'll have done it by the end of the first quarter. Not just because of them, but because we have to move on. We can't keep this thing lingering. And finally, it might have to go to the Constitutional Court. So, when we have these hearings, I have been asked, obviously, I don't know, there's a big hoo-ha about what I said, but I'm completely unapologetic. I did the right thing. It's the correct thing to say. We cannot, as Parliament, be seen to be supine. We are Parliament. We can't have a president, even if it's Madiba, say to us, a bill is unconstitutional, and we all tremble and say, okay, it's unconstitutional. No. That's not the way Parliament works. Go and change the rules. And not while I'm here. Okay? So, on that matter, I'm unapologetic. We will not tremble for any president. Nothing to do with President Zuma. We are Parliament. We have constitutional powers. Nobody, no lawyer is, or two lawyers or three lawyers in one team are sacrosanct, wherever they come from. Parliament must get its independent opinion, which is what we're doing now. And yes, we must amend the bill if we think it's unconstitutional. But if it is not, and there's consensus among lawyers that it's not, then we don't amend it. Why should we amend it? That's the point. That's what a parliamentary chair is supposed to say. There's no choice I have about it. That's the way Parliament functions. That's what the constitutions and the rules parameters define for a chair to say. But let me be clear, comrades, colleagues. There are other issues that are surfacing, and I would urge all the parties, not least the majority party, to get a proper mandate around those things. About our relationship between our national sovereignty and the credit rating agency-like organizations and the World Bank and so on, whatever you want to say, and this, what's this, FATF. So that discussion, Pinky, you are right. Let the ANC study group discuss that and go to those issues we must have. Now the question I want to ask you, Mr. Advocate Jenkins, I've been approached by lots of radio stations. I only finally agreed to one to clarify, hey, guys, and look at the crude question I got. Let me tell you what the question was. You're under pressure, Chairperson, to agree to this thing. I said, no. I was responding to the EFF, who were saying we're going to, you know, be supine and we're going to give in here and so on. No, I was responding to a particular debate, but I'm correct to say that. And I'm saying what an average chairperson would say. There's nothing like, you're very courageous. What courage? I just did what I'm supposed to do. The courage comes from the rules. And that's Parliament's set of conventions. And the Constitution, which came out of the titanic mass struggles of the people, not Cyril Ramaphosa alone. You know? So what I'm saying in short is, there's nothing, I just did the right thing. I'm doing my job. Now, some people will be unhappy about it, and they can take whatever action they want. But, hey, you know what? I didn't shape the Constitution. I'm peripheral to it. I didn't choose the rules. They are there. So we're going to stick with the rules. But parties can come to their position. Now, the one thing I want to ask you, Mr. Jenkins, before we draw to a close. As I understand it, these submissions we receive, we will do the normal process, comrades and colleagues. We ask them for written submissions. And as happens, if any of them want to come for oral, we will accept them. Unless members can show me why we should be any different this time, right? But presumably, they will have to comment on the constitutionality of this provision. So would it be reasonable to ask them to give us their legal opinions? Because that's what it's about. Well, how would we go about it? Because it's about the unconstitutional. What has happened to previous such... to finish my answer to your question, I got distracted. Then your Thursday morning, our Mr. Beru and Mr. Frolic, and your, I think, whoever is in that meeting Thursday, explained the position. So, in the afternoon when I spoke to Mr. Bengu, he said Frolic had explained the thing. And according to the information I got, was done. So I presume you were reported to, or you engaged around it. So I took it you knew. There was one thing that Mr. Mania raised that I think I should raise in fairness. He said, according to his reading, remember, Frank, I spoke to you about it. If we proceed with this thing, and we decide that, let's say we're making these changes, or you're not making any changes. Then we don't have to go to the NCOP. That was his reading of the rules. I raised it with you. You said initially you think it's not right, but you'll check it out. Can we reply to that question? That was what you raised with me. That was the only outstanding issue, and then I thought he will deal with it when he comes here today. Can you respond to that one?
As a 75 legislation, having a substantive defect, it goes straight from here to the House, to the President. It does not go through the NCOP. That's
okay. That's settled. Then now, on the issue of how we manage these public hearings on the 24th of January, which we're now agreeing on, how would we do it?
So the issue that the mandate you have from the House in terms of the rules is just to look at the reservation, just to look at the problem with this bill, why it was sent back. So this is now not written in the rules, but we are spending money and time on this exercise, and that money and time is meant for the mandate. So if someone comes here from the public to make submissions on other issues, Chairperson, your duty would be to stop that person and say, just focus on this issue. This is what we're doing in this committee. The other issues, if it's about the review of the bill itself, the House has decided, Parliament has decided the bill is fine, so therefore we can't open it again. So the other issues, just by example, some of the definitions of a politically important person, I can't remember the exact word, those are settled. One cannot go into that and reopen that. So members of the public should take note of that as well, and the submissions as well. And to ask someone for a legal opinion, I don't see anything problematic about that. Some lawyers will say, but there is the issue of client privilege. But if that client comes to us, and I'm not sure if client privilege applies in this instance, in fact, I don't think it does, but if the client comes to us, and I know it's the person who got the legal opinion, it's up to them to decide, well, I'll give you my legal opinion or not. It doesn't pertain to the lawyers. So if someone doesn't want to give the legal opinion, fair enough, then they must say what they want to say and not give it. But it certainly would help to get that. But in the end, Parliament must make up its own mind where it is, because I mean we are going to get different legal opinions, and there's been a few written already on this provision. So there's no problem getting...
See if people agree with me. One, we get independent senior counsel opinion ready by, say, the 15th or so of January, right? Then I will send it out to the members. Two, the first sitting on the 24th of January, maybe what we do. You see, but I think the public should also be exposed to the legal opinions, to be fair, so there's a dialogue. So let's start the public hearings on the 24th. So we advertise Alan Tebo for public submissions, and we will, between yourself, Mr. Frolic, and me, Cedric Frolic and me, we'll craft the advert, right? I think the advert should go in. You see, if we put the advert in now, it's holiday time, so to speak, and so on. Let's put the advert, let's draft the advert and get it ready by next week and put it in, say, by the 7th, 8th of January, and then give people... Or do you think we should put the advert in now? Okay, can you leave that to us? Maybe you put the advert in now. Hey, we can put the advert in now. I don't know. Look, between us, we will decide if you leave it to us, right? Whatever's the better option. Then what we do is we request, where possible, that people give us legal opinion, so it helps. Then what I think I do, because I don't want to talk to the media particularly, I mean, I'm old now, and really, I'm not interested in all that, really. I didn't know this was going to become such a big issue. So I issue a statement summarizing this committee meeting, which is to say, one, that we have heard legal opinion from Parliament. We've heard the FIC and National Treasury just summarized in a sentence or two, Advocate Jenkins. Then that the committee feels, one, that we should have public hearings. Two, that we'll appoint an independent counsel. And three is that it's a matter really around the constitutionality of this provision. And if we get consensus one way or the other, the MPs will be relieved, or not, will be happy, because then, you know, it's not a policy matter. As far as the policy matters go, we have to put that in the report. And then if you want to review, as Pulemabi is saying, he must get a mandate from his party for that, all the warrantless searches, and if his party agrees, party that I also come from, that is a matter that the ANC will bring in our report to Parliament. And as I see it, am I right to say, Advocate, ultimately this committee has only three options. One, to say that we need to amend the bill to make it more constitutionally sound. Is that correct? Two, is we can say there's nothing to amend, actually, and we refer it back to the president, in which case he refers it to the Constitutional Court or he assents to it. Right. And three is we can delete the clause. Right. So those are the three options. Am I right? Ultimately, that's what it's about. Then the next thing I want to ask you, if you return the bill to the president, whether you amend it or not, does he normally refer it to the Constitutional Court?
Go through, and this one of the questions that came out about time frames. There's nothing for
there's
us.
There's no time frames, yeah.
There's no time frames.
Yeah,
when
clear.
The president gets it back, yeah. He will get legal advice on it again.
Right.
Whether it's just plain as it was, he'll probably get a second legal opinion. If we've changed it, he'll probably get a second opinion. Decide whether he will refer it to the courts or not.
All right.
He can only refer it if he doesn't agree. And it's a formal referral. He must make a proper application with counsel submitting affidavits why he thinks and it's unconstitutional, and we have to serve it on Parliament, and we can respond why we think it is.
All right, can I ask another question? Colleagues, can you pay attention, because we need to be clear about the parameters within which we have to do this process. If, let's say, we can't come to agreement, you know, one lawyer says one thing, another lawyer says another thing, and we say, hey, this is not a policy matter. The policy matter is going to our report, and we can ask for the bills to be brought back within a year with the sort of points Pule Mavi is making. On this matter now, can we refer it to the Constitutional Court if we don't arrive at?
Unfortunately not. We cannot. It's still a bill. It's not signed. In the interim constitution, there's provision for Parliament to refer a bill after it's passed to the... Yes. Yes, no,
you absolutely, we can't do it, because I asked you that question earlier.
You
all right, so then that rules it out, because one of the options I was going to put to this committee is if there's not sufficient consensus amongst the lawyers on the constitutionality, not the policy issues now, then we must, it's not a matter that MPs can kill ourselves about, we're not lawyers, that then we must refer it to the Constitutional Court, let it decide. Then can we now raise all the policy issues around it, that on reflection 4 months later, beyond the unconstitutionality, we have other issues we'd like raised. Can we do that in our report? Like, say, we have a reservation about warrantless searches on further reflection. Explain why suddenly 4 months later we do. Can we do that?
Chair, I would advise against it, because the process in the House, according to the joint rules, is also limited only to the reservations of the President. So the committee might say, well, look, at what about all these other pieces of legislation? But that would be for a matter... I won't put it in the report. I would rather just speak in the House and get called to order.
Right, we'll find another way of dealing with that. In other words, let's do what the law requires us to do, Mr. Konkwa and Pule Mave, on this matter. Then we do another report on the policy issues, and then people can take it to their party policy conferences, and they can take it to their chief whips, and we can then table it as a separate report and have a debate in the House, if you like. On the matter. So I also think, let's tread cautiously, let's just do what the rules require us, but invariably I know what's going to happen. People are going to raise issues about FATF and PEP and all that, and so on, and we will try to manage it as best as we can. So the statement will go along those lines, that it's primarily a legal matter, but we accept there are policy issues that can be addressed in some appropriate forum. So what we can do, colleagues, let's see how it goes so that we're all clear about what we are saying. What we can do is, if people talk outside the terrain, we sort of flag it and say, yeah, for now deal with this issue, and these are other issues that we will deal with in some way as the majority party and so on through our constitutional structures, party political structures and so on. So I think I'll issue a short statement along those lines immediately, and then I'm not taking any calls, really, because I don't want to get involved in this thing. It's the committee that decides. As I told people yesterday, I'm just doing my job here. The committee might decide tomorrow something else, and that's their right. So that's broadly the direction.
Chair.
Yeah.
Don't call us, we'll call you.
Okay. So finally, on this note, thank everybody. Yes, you asked about something that started. I just...
Chair, three things. I'm waiting for the total number of warrantless searches conducted by the FIC. That's the first thing. The second thing is, I made a proposal for us, for the committee, to request the relevant documents from the presidency. I want to know if that's been agreed to or if it hasn't been agreed to. And then again, I do think that there is an element of urgency, and we as a committee should commit to trying to get this matter resolved, obviously, or dealt with, obviously, according to the rules and within the procedures, so that it can be debated on the first day, which according to at least the preliminary program, is the 21st of February 2017. The sugar tax, the sugar tax is hardly more important than this.
Yeah, can I raise something though, colleagues? I would like to hear the ANC's response to this. We are we're moving in that direction in our report to Parliament. That, yeah, it's important to take part in this globalized community, right? But we're not going to be like held to ransom. I want to raise something else with you, by the way. There's a conference taking place on Friday, right? Friday. Let me tell you guys this. I have to report to you on it anyway. Well, I don't have to, but I'll do my report. The Speaker's office. Let me tell you something. There's a conference taking place on Friday in London. Convened, guess by who? The UK, London. The people that do taxes in London, in the UK House of Commons, it's called the Public Accounts Committee. They're having a conference. It's called the Global Conference on Tax Transparency. If you look at the Concordat, which I've taken to, I've spoken to Comrade Boroto. I spoke to Comrade Frolic. And I'm asking, why are we having a conference in London about illicit financial flows and base erosion and profit shifting when ours is one of the countries that's regarded as the, I think, see Murray Mitchell here, 10th, I've been doing a bit of work around this. It's horrific. Interestingly, I should switch this off because I don't want to. It's very good that parliaments are now coming on the act. This is called the Global Tax Transparency Conference. But it's completely dominated by the developed world. In fact, the only developing world speaker there is myself, from what I can see. Right? And now I'm officially opening it. Right? So I've consulted with the Speaker's office about it. One is, that's what I'm saying to you, I said to you last week, we must have the next conference here in Cape Town. And on behalf of the Speaker's office, it's been agreed to. No, you can't do these things there. If you have it in Africa, our brothers and sisters in Zimbabwe can come and Mozambique can come. How many chairpersons are going to end up there, right? Secondly, that formulation, it's too Eurocentric, right? But why is this conference why can't it be held in a mining economy in a developing world, and the amount of money being spent on it, maybe the British Parliament paying, should be here. So I'm going there, I've got the endorsement of the Speaker's office on this matter, the Deputy Speaker, the Comrade Boroto, the House Chair for International, and the Chair, I've spoken to them. And we have a BRICS Parliamentary Forum now. And we should call a conference here first of the BRICS countries. Because the people who are losing with these illicit financial flows are the developing countries. All these regulations that they are adopting, MoMA, I've been doing some reading in the last day and a half in between all my other work. It's very striking that even this country-by-country reporting, even the automatic exchange of information, the developed countries will actually be far better able to draw from that than we would be able to on this continent. Because we don't have the capacity they have. So even when you have international regulations, and it's very interesting when these international regulations came up. They came up after 9/11 and 2008, when the developed countries realized that, hey, they need country-by-country reporting and automatic exchange of information. So invariably, Pinky, when you raise these issues, from a point of a communist, actually, we're on the same page. But we have to find the right tactical choices when we do what. That's the difference we might have. I have no problem with people who say, I'm going there to say the same things. Right? Don't care. Today is the last day today. And it's 22-1, so I've got a good 20 more minutes to go. Right. So no. We must raise these issues. It's parliamentarians that must lead. Now, obviously, when I go there,
I'll have to manage this thing, right? About the unconstitutionality of this provision. And so it's going to come up. You're talking about, yeah, you know, all these things. But let me put something to you, and I'll do you the report for you. The point I'm trying to make is, I really feel, members, that with due respect to you, Mr. Mania, this thing about artificially trying to meet that deadline, can you please relent on that? We will seek to do it. The sugar tax is very important. Farmers has gone on strike. Not strike, they've been marching on your offices. Right? And it'll be wrong because they can regulate this thing. They can regulate this thing. Am I right? Can I get some clarity? You can regulate without Parliament having a say. Is that right? On the sugar tax.
No.
Right. So we want to have public hearings. This will affect workers' jobs, but on the other hand, we have to balance it out against the health thing. So I'm not having a position myself on the sugar tax thing. I don't know what the ANC's position is on it. The right balances have to be found. I support the sugar tax, but I also support jobs. So we need to find the right balance. Yeah, I'm just saying that's where I am, right? Now the ANC, I don't know what it's for. We need to find the right, it's your government that's actually bringing that tax forward, right? So I don't think we should drop the sugar tax. Having said that, I'm throwing it open now. On the first two issues, the other issue about meeting the deadline, we will try to do it expeditiously with due consultation, like we did this FSR bill, 200 plus hours. Well, we'll do it, but we're not going to meet any artificial deadline. Your mid-February deadline, well, we're interested to hear, but we're not going to meet that artificially. Sifiso.
Chair, I totally agree with you about the process forward, and I think let's stick to that. Yeah, that's one. Two, I'm not very sure why Honorable Meniru would like to find the founding, the papers from the legal advice that the President got, and so on, the fact of the matter is that the President has come to a particular determination, and that's what we need to deal with, and the process that you have suggested, that's how we're going to be looking at, as to what other the documents that they relied on, and so on. I think it's neither here nor there. So that part, I don't think David will go to war about. They've told us, they've given us the reasons.
By the way, with this last bill that the President returned, what is the MPRDA bill? They didn't make any changes, right? And they returned it. Is that correct? What happened to that?
The bill has to be referred to the National House of Traditional Leaders. That is the concern. So that they've done.
And then what happened?
Then it goes through the NCOP and it's sent back with proof that it...
What has happened in previous cases? What usually happens in the Parliament? Do they actually ask for these documents or not?
Chair, I looked
at... Does Parliament have the right to call the President's lawyers also to have a say so we can hear fully? We can read Sifiso. We can read the 7 pages or 8 pages of the President's lawyers. But to seek clarity, it might be necessary to call them. Yeah, in fairness, everybody who's got a legal opinion, it's something we need. What happens normally? What does Parliament normally do? Then we can decide later whether we want to...
We haven't called on those documents. Sometimes what we receive is the bill back with a letter from the President as well as submissions from the public that were sent to the President. Sometimes there's a legal note with it or not. And it's been inconsistent. Of the 11 or 12 bills, there's about 4 or 5 that came with documents. Others didn't come. And the committees discussing it have not requested specifically President's legal opinion or anything like that. In fact, what you're suggesting, Mr. Karim, Chairperson, that we ask for the public to give submissions, that rarely happens as well. But I think it's a constitutional requirement to do that. I think we should do it. I think that's what the Constitution envisages. Because it's a process, but usually we don't call for papers. We look at it, either we send it straight back. That happened right in the beginning, the liquor bill case, and it was found unconstitutional. Mostly we look at the concerns, deal with it. There's one or two that was public participation issues. That's very easy. In fact, you just go through the process. So.
For now, let me consult further with the Speaker's office on these matters. Secondly, at this stage, we will not call the President's legal team or ask for the papers, but if it's necessary, we'll look into it, because it's not about whether Mr. Mania asks for it or not. It's what's the right thing to do. If there's sufficient consensus on the matter, then fine. And I hope we get sufficient consensus. It's a legal matter, really. If it's unconstitutional, let's sort it out. If it's not, let's return it. That's all you can do. So basically, let's leave that matter in abeyance. I think let's get advice on the matter.
Now, if you're saying to me this has never been done before where we've asked for submissions, can you listen, Pinky, please, so that we're on the same page in understanding the issues? It is this. This has never happened before, that when you have had the president return a bill to parliament because one or other provisions are unconstitutional, that we've actually asked for oral submissions and written submissions. Is that correct, Advocate Jenkins?
Yes, Chair.
Right. So we are creating new territory here, consistent with the spirit of what parliament's supposed to be. Similarly, we must actually look at what the implications are, legal and other, of the issues about engaging with the president's lawyers, because it might be helpful to them. They might themselves want to come and explain what it is they're saying in those 7 or 8 pages, because they're not here to answer for themselves. We are interpreting what they say. They should have a fair right to be heard as well. But whether people are raising it for adversarial reasons or not, it should be separated from what a popular parliament is meant to be, an organ of people's power. We have to hold the executive to account. Right. So that's a separate issue. Now I want to raise something else. Mr. Mania asks, how many warrantless searches have there been? In fact, that's a thought that struck me as well. Does this happen often? And in those cases, have the people who were subjected to this taken the matter to court, and what has been the outcome?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Since 1 April 2011, when the FIC first started doing inspections, there's been 930 inspections up until end of March this year, which was the end of the previous financial year. So those are the audited figures that we have and that were published in our annual reports. It's 930 inspections. All of those were done without a warrant, and all of those were done with the consent of the inspected party. So in each one of those cases, and we've at a different stage, it might be good to hear from supervisors how the inspection processes work and what information we provide the inspected party before we go to them and how we get confirmation of their consent to the inspection. So it's a fairly rigorous process to make sure that the inspected party knows why we are coming there and on what basis they're giving their consent to the inspection. So all of those were done on the basis of that consent provision. There was also a question on the frustrations that we've experienced. Obviously, in the FIC's case, we've not experienced any frustrations with these inspections because these were all done on the basis of consent. The one case where there wasn't consent given, where consent was sought, was in the case of Auction Alliance, which was an inspection that would have been done by the Estate Agency Affairs Board. And there was serious frustrations experienced. And after the Constitutional Court's decision, there was a reading in provision that then allowed the warrant to be sought. And at every point where a warrant was applied for, that application was opposed. Now, I've lost touch with the case recently, but to my knowledge, to today, that warrant has still not been obtained for that inspection to have been carried out. So that inspection is still in abeyance. So that is the extreme example of what can happen if there is a concerted effort to frustrate the process.
All right. Can we take Tandi first, maybe, because you've been speaking a lot. Tandi?
No, Chair.
I have to do that, Tandi, for once. Maybe at the end of the year. That's
right. No.
Today, Tandi's not speaking enough.
No, Chair, I said I don't want to huff and puff, and I had a reason why I said so. Because, you see, we might want to get into the discussion that you need to deal with at the later stage. Because the gist of the matter that is under discussion is the warrantless search and whether it's constitutional or not. And once we entertain questions about it and there's responses, it can trigger engagement and we have opinions. Now, I said, let's deal with process matters and then the rest of the issues we deal with them at the justice. But you don't listen to
me. Because Mr. Kwanka raised it and Pule Mabe raised it, but then I decided, hey, you know what, it's cutting across parties and you're right. Actually, strictly speaking, you're ruling me out of order. I rule myself out of order. So it's fine. It's agreed. Mr. Mania, you know what? I think also we must get the public here on the same day we get these three interviews. So how we'll start that public hearing, let's hear the legal opinion from our senior counsel will come first because Parliament is most primary. Treasury will find some, presumably senior counsel, sympathetic to them. So, hey, we'll be a bit cautious about them. And so I'm amazed that Mr. Kwankwa wants to get a his little party is going to get legal opinion. I don't know where they'll get the funding for it, but great. then Phule Mabe is now committing. Phule Mabe is committing our own study group as the ANC, as the leader of our study group, that he will fund independent legal opinion. Can you minute that, please, Tebogo? So it's fine. So we can have lots of legal opinions. Let everybody be heard in the morning. And so can we please not complain? We're going to sit for the whole day on the 24th. So the morning will be submissions. Let everybody hear. And then as soon as you guys finish with all your submissions late in the morning, we have the public, whoever wants to respond, along the lines we've agreed to respond. Yes, Mr. Mania.
Just want to clarify. So the answer to my question is that you've conducted 930 searches without a warrant. That is not the... And I conclude from that you've in fact then conducted zero warrantless searches. In other words, searches where you've had to rely on provisions in respect of the fact that you'd conduct a search, but that the warrant would the exceptional provisions where you believe that it might be delayed or that the purpose of the search might be interrupted. So in other words, you've conducted zero warrantless searches. Is that correct?
Okay, answer, because it's asked so directly, but we're stopping here. But you have to repeat these things. The minutes of this meeting, can I suggest something? In fairness to people who are not here, who might have a strong view, the minutes of the meeting, Zakhela, you'll oversee it, will also be submitted to the people who are here. And then I'll summarize the minutes, and then we'll pick up. These issues should be dealt with. Thandi's absolutely right there. But in fact, two members here raised it, apart from Mr. Mania, so one has to spill over and be fair. Quickly, a response.
As quick as possible, yes, Chair. No, we've not conducted inspections where we believed we would have obtained a warrant and went ahead on that basis with a warrantless inspection, because that provision isn't in our law yet. We can't rely on it. We have no authority to do so. So we can only operate on a consent or on the getting a warrant.
Antonio and Zakhele, will you put a question answer thing and we give it to people who are not here and say, look, this is what emerged in the committee, these are tentative views, and the people will come with their legal opinions. That's it. Can I take this opportunity of thanking everybody? It's been quite a difficult, challenging year. And I wish you well over the constituency period stroke vacation. And we will be back on the 24th of January with these public hearings. Thank you.
Thank you, sir. Okay, have a good Christmas. I'm going to go to the next one.